over here, you won't really be on next camera.
You have to sort it to get your wisdom.
Good morning and welcome to the Public Safety Neighborhoods Quality of Life Committee meeting. And thank you to my colleagues, Vice Chair Commissioner Suarez and Commissioner Magazine for joining us. Happy Valentine's Day to everybody, and also happy Ash Wednesday to those who observe. May you have a meaningful Lent season. Today's meeting will be hybrid. Members of the public who wish to join virtually can do so via Zoom. The webinar ID is 878-3335-2956. And they can dial in by calling 312-626-6799 or toll free at 888-475-4499. Stephanie, are there any announcements?
Yes, we have a couple of announcements. We have one item that is deferred. It is going to be item number 22, discuss regulations pertaining to electric vehicles and devices along with city enforcement efforts and any additional regulations that may be necessary to aid in ensuring the safe operations of electrical vehicles and devices for all. Again, that item is item number 22. We also have a couple of time certains. Item number 27 will have a time certain of 10 a.m. Item number 26 will have a time certain of 10:30 a.m. Item number 1 will have a time certain of 10:45, and item 10 will be a time certain of 10:45 as well.
Which one?
1 and 10 are 10:45. And then we will have a time certain for item number 24 at 1 p.m., and item number 2 will have a time certain at 1:45. And those are the only announcements for today.
Thank you. Should we get started with item 27?
We can.
Madam Chair, and I'd like to defer item 25.
Morning.
Morning. Hey, I want to defer item 25. Deferred.
Which item?
25.
And also, I want to welcome Commissioner Fernandez for being here. Thank you so much for coming.
Pleasure. Good morning. Good night.
I thought it was in the regular.
Okay, item 27.
Okay, so we will be hearing item number 27, discuss humane removal of animals from crawl spaces prior to mitigation of tenting. We have facilities and fleet. Is that the item?
Good morning. Elizabeth Miro, interim director for facilities and fleet management for the record. The item speaks to the humane removal of animals in crawl spaces. In terms for city buildings, we do have a pest control contract that requires for these areas to be inspected prior to the removal of any animals. We have with us today a program, Linda and Holly, who can speak in terms of what we can do for residential facilities.
So I'm Linda Diamond. I'm the president of Sobey Cat Spay and Neuter and also the chair of the Animal Welfare Committee. Mm-hmm. I'm Holly Whalen, coordinator for the city. First ever. So the issue at hand is that we have a lot of cats and animals in general that are getting stuck underneath buildings during fumigations or when you try to bring your building up to code. You are supposed to have lattice or something breathable around the outside. So what's happening are that animals are getting stuck. And we're always called out last minute.
Yeah.
And it's not just affecting the animals. It's affecting property owners, property managers, building residents. We've had a situation where a building was fumigated, and the day they're putting up the tent, we get notified that there's animals underneath. A resident tells us. Then, last minute, the fumigator says, well, I'm not going to fumigate. I know that there's animals underneath there. So now the property manager has to give one whole extra day of housing to their residents because they were covering the cost of the housing. Holly's out there trying to get the cats out from under the movie for 6 hours. The property manager's upset, the owner's upset, the residents are upset. And we've had situations where 10 cats were found dead, 11, 8, 7, I mean, 3.
Yeah.
And we probably get a call most of them. So what do we have in our toolbox to address this? Right now, we do have building code that says that you do have to close off with some kind of screening crawl spaces. That's that. Second thing we have is animal cruelty. Okay, so if you do have an animal that you're putting under any situation where they're going to die painfully, they don't have access to water, food, that's animal cruelty. But that doesn't work because all the owner has to do is say, I didn't see him. And that's all we have to fall back on. So we've got two really cheap and easy ideas. So we have about 200 to 300 registered cat feeders all over Miami Beach. If they register with us, we know they're not going to litter. They're going to make the cats invisible. They'll report to us what cats need to be fixed. So they know their cats. They know their colonies. But they never know this is going to happen until their tents are going up. So we propose to put out signage 2 weeks before crawl spaces are being closed, whether it's for fumigation or other reasons. So our feeders can see the sign and then call us and we can address it. The second thing is when you do close up, you can buy a $15 one-way cat door or dog door that swings, and you can set it to only swing one way. So they can get out, but they can't get back in. $15. That would save so much angst for their property managers, property owners, residents, us, and a lot of tears from people that actually do care about the animals that are caught underneath there. We also discussed potentially doing fines and, you know, don't really know the best way that would work. But this is what we have in front of us. So any questions so far?
Sure. Yeah. Find anything besides cats? Or,
yes, all animals.
Possums,
raccoons, everything.
And the dog, the door, the one-way door, it's only $15.
On Amazon.
So how do you, where does it get installed?
So they install it on a piece of plexiglass. It's really, really easy. It comes with a template. They just cut it out. It bolts like side by side, and then they just bolt it to wherever the crawl space is.
Okay.
I mean, when we're informing the residents now and building owners to do it, they are doing it, and we are very successful at getting the animals out with it.
And who would be required to put the signage in? Property owner or the fumigation company?
Property manager. Because we really don't have any control over the fumigation organizations. They're not all based in Miami Beach, so right. To regulate them to do X, Y, Z is a lot harder.
And how do you, by the way, I'm an animal guy, okay? How do you plan on messaging out to all the management companies that this is the new, if we were to move forward with this, that this is the new law that you have to put outside it?
We would educate as we do now about the cat program. So if, and any kind of ordinance that's out there, such as why do they know to close their call spaces? How do they know to do that?
Right.
A lot of it is knocking door to door. A lot of it is getting our team of 200 to 300 feeders to start educating where around where they're feeding.
Sure.
So it'll take time to get it to catch on.
Well, I'm supportive.
Commissioner Fernandez?
Yes, and thank you so much. I think, Commissioner Dominguez, were you the sponsor of this
item? Yes, and I believe Vice Chair Suarez was the co-sponsor.
Wonderful. And certainly anything that we can do to protect animals. We are very pet-friendly community, and I think we all love animals. Just a few points I want to go through. Is any other jurisdiction doing something like this at the moment?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
We do have a Humane Society meeting coming up in Texas where there's a whole session on ordinances, but that's more about eating. I didn't see a whole lot of about animals.
And what would it be, let's say, we do pass a regulation like this on signage and having to have the door for the animal to be able to get out? If someone does not comply, what would be potentially then the violation or the penalty for something like this?
That's the next item where it's could we implement? Could we implement a fine? What would that apply?
Okay. And so I guess the bigger problem is that right now the building code requires for crawl spaces to be enclosed?
Closed. Yeah, so Section 58.292, every opening beneath the building, including basement or cellar windows and crawl spaces, shall be equipped with an approved type of screening or lattice work to keep out any animals. So that's already there. It doesn't say how to get them out.
But if property owners would be abiding by that section of the code, technically animals wouldn't be getting in there.
Correct.
And perhaps and perhaps what we should be doing a better job at is making sure that property owners are abiding by this code already. And I think that that perhaps should be part of the effort.
I actually think where this would be best suited is right under that section to say, and should animals be located under that building or to allow animals to get out at ample time, a one-way door installed for 2 weeks would be the next step.
Right.
Because it does say they have to close it. It says nothing about helping animals get out better air.
Right. So if they are going to bring their building up to code, and there's animals living in it, they just get seal it and all that stuff.
Right.
Which is another, we've had one field which wasn't even to code, was cement.
Yeah.
We had feeders trying to shift through cement to get animals out. They're like screaming on the other side. So as long as we have something to go back on to say, hey, yes, I know you are to code, you're closing that up, but get those guys out first.
Right. I guess my only concern is that, you know, property owners sometimes need to do things on an emergency basis, or they get, you know, they get notified that all of a sudden there's a rat infestation, and they have the opportunity to get a fumigator in there quickly. But now we're saying, hey, listen, we're going to delay you for 2 weeks. So now the tenants, who are our residents as well, for 2 weeks, they're going to have to be dealing with a nuisance like a rodent or something like that for a longer period of time.
Well, I don't believe that they tent. The tents are what's killing all the cats.
It's tents, not other types of fumigation.
Or starving to death because they're locked under a closed crawl space.
Right.
And there's no fumigation.
Right.
All right.
So
this would only apply specifically only when we do full tents of buildings.
Full tents.
Okay.
Full tents.
And
full
we're
tents
sure.
Off in
okay.
general.
If that's the case,
enclosed in the crawl.
If that's the case, then I'm fine.
Just to be clear, because it's not just fumigation. It's whenever you walk off a crawl space, even to become to code. And that's not going to take up time. While you're closing it, put the one-way door.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Is there any public comment?
We don't have any public comment right
Is
now.
Anybody moving the item?
I move it.
Okay. So we're moving it to recommend to commission.
Yes.
With a favorable recommendation with these ideas.
That's correct.
Okay. Everyone agrees?
Yes. Okay. Number 16.
Thank you.
Yes.
Item number 16 is discuss on the Miami Beach Commission for Women recommendation for co-naming a Miami Beach street in honor of Naomi Wozniak. We have Jose presenting the item.
Thank you. So the Miami Beach Commission for Women had put forth earlier in the year, actually maybe last year, that there were about 18 streets that were named after men and there were none after women, and they put forward two names, both are items on today's agenda, Gloria Estefan and Naomi Wilzig. And Jose, if you would share that.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members, Jose Gonzalez, Transportation and Mobility Director. So the city has a process, an ordinance, that governs street co-names. One of the first things that needs to happen once there is a recommendation for a street co-naming is to ensure that the code allows for that co-naming. Our code is actually very stringent in terms of street co-namings and only allows for co-namings under very specific criteria. Honoring a notable woman who has significantly impacted the city's history and culture currently is not one of those criteria. So one of the first things that needs to happen is for the code to be amended to allow, so include the criteria that will allow the code to be
talked. Rob, so in a situation like this, can we amend the item?
Amend.
It has to start from scratch and go to the commission as a code amendment.
You mean amended to something other than a woman who has made an impact on Miami Beach?
No. If I understand correctly, we can't put this referral through because the code doesn't permit it.
And that's what you're being asked to do, is to recommend that
street code be co-named. There's actually two items that are like that.
Yes. The first thing you do is you recommend that the ordinance be adopted to add this category, which is what you're doing today.
Okay. And how do my colleagues feel about that?
Sure, if I could. I see streets all over the city named after people. What allows for that and does not allow for this?
Well, it's the criteria that's been adopted over time.
And what would that, what would that be? What criteria allows for the streets that have currently been named but excludes this? What is that criteria?
So it says men that can name it after men, but no women?
If I may throw the chart, like for example, last year we did Andy Sweet.
Yep.
The Andy Sweet Street rename. So we created
and a rabbi too.
We also did a rabbi. Or if you look around Pride Park, we've done a few. So what we did was that we amended the code to establish criteria. So like with Andy Sweet, I think we established a criteria that was something like a photographer that documented Miami Beach history or something like that. And we were able to fit Andy Sweet in that criteria. I hate to put it in these terms. In essence, we are creating the loophole through which we can nominate these individuals that we want to name street actors, but it's a legal mechanism through which that we have to go through. And in this case, I think the recommendation is for the committee to recommend an amendment to the code to create the criteria of a street name that honors a notable woman who has contributed significantly to the city's history and culture, which Naomi significantly did. Naomi, she was a force and an incredible visionary. So I would certainly support.
Right, and I'm supportive of that, but I would just like to know why we need to create these loopholes every single year instead of just looking at the broader stringent criteria and say, let's broaden the umbrella.
I can answer that for you. The way the ordinance is written, that's the way it works. Like, if you want, it's meant to, I think, significantly narrow who can have a street named after them. And so if you wanted to, if you did want to name a street after somebody, it sort of requires you to go back and require it or create a category that they can fit into.
What are the other
ones? Sorry. You could, as a policy matter, if you wanted to, do something. You could change the ordinance, so it would be more general and give you more general authority, but that would open up more street
names. Okay, so I understand why it's tight. Vice Chair?
What are the criteria now?
We have the ordinance with
there. There are actually five criteria. The first one is a Miami Beach police officer who died or was killed in the line of duty. A public facility located on the city street to be coined, a private not-for-profit organization with significant historic value to the city and associated with structures which have a significant historic value or architectural significance to the city, geographic areas within the city to be coined, a commercial establishment that has been in business in the city of Miami Beach for 100 or more years and which is located on the street to be coined. Those very strict criteria.
Right. How did Rabbi...
because of this.
Because we added then, we created a section to say, a religious leader that contributed.
And then it sunsets.
Oh,
many times those criteria are created in such a way that they sunset after a certain
number. Would this one sunset as well?
If you set it up, if you draft it that way, yes.
Madam Chair, and I support your item, and perhaps this committee may want to consider at some point a recommendation to the City Commission where maybe we take away some of the red tape in renaming. Maybe we raise the voting threshold so that if it's the wish of the City Commission to rename a street after someone that's worthy, we don't have to go through this whole process that you're going through now of having to create the category and go through a first reading and a second reading to create a category, then have to go then through the whole process then of actually naming the street. That's clearly what we're going to have to go through here to do this, and we should, because it's certainly very worthwhile. But perhaps separately, we should look at maybe let's just streamline that process and just raise the voting threshold going forward.
Well, that's something to think about for the future. For today, are we okay with moving? Oh, is there any public comment?
There are no public
comments. Are we okay with moving forward?
I'd like to move forward with the sunset period.
Like, yes.
So.
Okay, so for Naomi, yes, all in favor? Okay. And then now item number 18, it's for Gloria Stefan, and it's for the small portion of the street in front of the Cardozo Hotel that her family has owned, and we all know Gloria Stefan and her contributions to the city of Miami Beach. Can we move this item? Okay. Oh, any public comment?
No.
Okay. okay. All in favor?
Yep.
With the same sunset period.
Yes, exactly. All right. So number 19.
We have Jose is here to present. It's going to be discussion on the potential implementation of a bicycle lane on the west side of Collins Ave as a part of the upcoming Florida Department of Transportation resurfacing and restoration and rehabilitation project on State Road SR-A1A/Collins Avenue from 907 West 53rd Street to 75th Street.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So AFDOT recently reached out to us and let us know that there is a project, an upcoming project that they are planning along Collins Avenue from 63rd Street to 75th Street. As with all AFDOT projects, it starts with a planning study. They completed the planning study, and as part of their due diligence, they brought to our attention the fact that they could potentially create a bike lane on the west side of Collins Avenue where there is currently on-street parking. And so the question that was posed to us by FDOT, if they continue to proceed with this project from the planning phase to the design phase and then ultimately the construction phase, the question that they posed is, would the city be interested in considering a bike lane on the west side of Collins Avenue within those project limits of 63rd Street to 75th Street? So we took a look at this issue and investigated it a bit and came up with that there are 75 existing on-street parking spaces on that west side of Collins Avenue, which would be impacted if the bike lane were to move forward. Collins Avenue, if you're familiar with that section, it's one way north. It's in North Beach. It's one way north. It's got three lanes, on-street parking on the west side, some on-street parking on the east side. And the issue is that it's very constrained. And so in order to accommodate a bike lane along that segment of the corridor, there's really only two options, either repurposing the on-street parking or repurposing a travel lane, meaning of the three lanes that are there traveling northbound, taking one of those and using it as a bike lane. So it would leave Collins with only two lanes northbound in that direction.
I have a question. So has there been a traffic study to see if the all three lanes are needed and if one can be repurposed? And actually, a couple questions. And also, has the Allison Park Neighborhood Association been contacted to see how they feel?
Madam Chair.
I worry about loss of parking in that area.
Madam Chair, to your question, the repurposing process is a separate process that the DOT would need to go through that is a lot more thorough and involved than the planning level study that they've done. So it has not been looked at with the impact of removing a lane from Collins Avenue in order to accommodate a bike lane. That impact has not been looked at as yet. That would be a separate process, probably several months.
Vice Chair?
The bike lane, would it only be one way? Or is it just going to be a southbound lane?
Or it would be a one-way northbound bike lane.
It's on the west side.
It's on the west side. In that section of Collins Avenue, it's one-way north. So the bike lane...
Technically, they can use a bike on the beach walk.
Yes.
Currently, in that
area. Regional bikes are allowed on the beach.
I think there's an item, I think it was you, Commissioner Fernandez, that has an item on packed sand on the beach.
The mayor, that's right.
So I think before we eliminate 75 parking spaces, that's a lot.
Yeah.
We should consider how that moves forward before we take parking away from people. You know, North Beach parking is like gold, right, Monica? And so I don't feel comfortable taking any parking spaces away, unfortunately. So, and including the fact that we're potentially building a bike lane on the beach, I think we should take a pause on it.
I feel exactly the same way. Stephanie, are there any public comments on this?
We have Matthew
Jay.
Madam Chair, may I present my item?
Yes. Commissioner Fernandez would like to speak.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate the city administration presenting my item. I referred this item to committee because specifically I feel that before we take action, we should get input from the community. I think that this is a type of issue we should workshop with the neighborhood associations and vet information from them. I've received concerns about the safety of bicyclists on the beach walk. A lot of people feel that there is too much bicycling activity on the beach walk and it's becoming unsafe for pedestrians on the beach walk. And so when the opportunity presented itself with the resurfacing of Collins Avenue to potentially explore the possibility of having a bicycle lane, I thought it would be appropriate to have that conversation with the neighbors. And one of the things that perhaps we could also be considering is that if Collins Avenue is not the viable option, well, is there a possibility in the future, whether through the state or individually through the city, doing on Indian Creek? That perhaps is something that could be explored, that perhaps would have a lesser impact on the parking facilities and a lesser impact on the traffic, but still alleviate the congestion that we see on the beach walk. The one thing I do want to highlight about this is that this is part of a bigger network. That south of this, we're working with FDOT, and Madam Chair, we had the pleasure through your leadership of meeting with FDOT in Tallahassee about some of the projects that they're doing in our city. But south of this portion, we're doing a bicycle lane that's protected from traffic that goes from 41st Street, I believe, up to 63rd. Up to 63rd Street. And so we should be discussing with the North Beach neighbors, how do we continue a bicycle facility north of 63rd Street? If it's not on Collins Avenue and if that's not feasible, well, perhaps then we could consider a separate alternative. Maybe it's Indian Creek. But what I value is before we make a recommendation, take a formal recommendation, let's work on a community meeting. Let's ask the administration to reach out to the neighborhood associations up in North Beach, get their input as to what they feel would be appropriate, and then come back to the committee with that feedback so we can issue a recommendation.
Thank you, Commissioner. Can we hear from the public?
Of course. First, we have Matthew, if we could unmute yourself. Matthew? You have 2 minutes.
Yeah. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. And I want to thank Commissioner Fernandez for bringing this item up to the committee to have a discussion. And I would agree with him that it is really important to have the conversation with the public, whether it's those in the immediate community or those who also, you know, live, work, and play all throughout Miami Beach. To the point, I think that we should step back and say, you know, 75 spots sounds like a lot. And sometimes it's frustrating when anytime there's a potential mobility improvement, including one that's on our master plans, the first thing that is evaluated is what is the impact to car parking. You know, we don't necessarily know the methodology that was used to come up with that number. The loss could be even greater than that, or it could be less. But I think it's important to look at this holistically. Collins Avenue is used by dozens of buses a day, carrying thousands of people. There's other options that could be looked at instead of a typical FDOT bike lane. There could be sidewalk level bike lanes that could potentially have less impact. There could be a shared bus bike lane that would not only have an improvement for bicyclists and potentially lessen the impact on the beach walk, but could also improve the flow of the thousands of people that ride public transportation in our city every day. So I want to stress that we should look at this and be creative and see how can we expand and implement our network, and how can we make mobility, whether it's cars, bicycling, scooters, e-scooters, or public transportation, better for everyone in this city. So thank you very much.
Thank you. We have one more caller, Patrick. If we could unmute Patrick. Patrick, you have 2 minutes.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. My name is Patrick Brushick. I live next to Pride Park, which I know you guys are going to talk about later, so I appreciate your time on that. But as far as the bike lanes, I wanted to encourage you to really think about how we can increase cyclist safety in our city. We haven't added any significant bike lanes since COVID, which we actually took some away when we used to have the bike lanes on Washington Avenue. So we've actually decreased our bicycle access. And just this weekend, I was riding my bike on the beach walk and told that I had to leave the beach walk and go on to Collins Avenue because I only have an e-bike. I was pedaling it. My motor was off, but our current policy, the park ranger said, even if you're pedaling, you have to get off of the bicycle, off of the beach walk and go into this traffic. Because that's the current policy of the city. So I'd encourage you to, one, revisit that policy, that if people are biking and pedaling their bikes, a lot of us live in small apartments and we can't have a regular bike and an e-bike. So we might just have an e-bike, and I was forced off of the boardwalk. So when you say that the boardwalk is an option for a cyclist, it's not an option for all the cyclists that live in compact situations on the beach. So I just appreciate your thoughts about increasing our bicycle safety and not forcing people off of the beach walk. Thank you.
Thank you. And that is it for public comment.
Right. So if somebody is on an e-bike, but they're pedaling, they're still kicked off. Like, why would that happen?
Because I think a lot of people pretend that we've had a lot of incidents where people have the e-bikes and they alternate back and forth. So it's been very hard to manage when someone is actually using the electric or versus the or pedal.
Vice Chair.
I love the idea. Okay, because I have more miles on my scooter than my car. What's concerning to me is that it's only northbound. So, you know, if a resident goes northbound and he has to come back southbound, then then he doesn't have a dedicated bike lane and it's not as safe. I think Commissioner Fernandez is right. I think we need to reach out to neighborhoods and their associations and just get a pulse for it before we make any sort of before we make any sort of formal recommendation. I suggest we reach out to neighborhoods. Ideally, if we're going to implement this, we should have it on the southbound lane too, on Indian Creek. That way, if someone's going north as a resident, they can come back south safely as well. So I think that's super important. I guess they can probably come up Abbott or Indian Creek beats Abbott and then down. But
And just for clarification, Abbott Avenue does have a dedicated bike lane southbound.
And where does it end?
It ends,
I believe it ends at Indian Creek, right?
Just north of that.
Yeah, because I've taken my scooter to North Beach all the time.
So let's give the direction for the Transportation Department to work with the Allison Park Neighborhood Association, the North Beach Alliance, any other organizations that are up in North Beach, and bring it back for a future date.
Yeah, if to reach out to the neighborhood associations north of 63rd Street, And if I may, just how much time do you guys think you'll need for the report to come back to committee?
I think probably a month or two.
Okay, so let's say...
For the April date?
For the April date.
Okay, for the April committee.
Can we also give direction for a southbound lane on Indian Creek?
Because the Abbott one is currently north?
No, no, Abbott is south. But there's already a bike lane going south on Abbott. On Abbott. But it ends at,
it ends at 69th Street, which is
right. Right. So it ends at 69th, which is just one block away from Indian Creek. So what I'm saying is, if we're going to have a loop, if we're going to have a direction going north on Collins,
let's look for a connector.
We should have a loop.
Okay.
And if I may, the intent is to just look in general in that North Beach area, the bicycle connectivity on Collins and then create northbound, southbound to study that.
If we're going to go with this, let's go all the way,
right?
Instead of half, literally half. So,
and that's the intent.
Okay, let's bring it back for April. Yes, of course.
Yeah, I agree. It has to be part of a more well thought out master plan, which I'm happy to entertain. Jose, just logistically, one question I have to you as the transportation expert. You're traveling northbound on Collins Avenue, and we're going to have a bike lane on the westernmost lane. So the only place people are turning, if not into a building, if you have to make a left onto a side street, you're going to have two lanes of cars doing so across the bike lane. Is that something that is one common? Okay, right? Because I'm looking at this, traveling this way in a car, your bike lane's here. The only way to make a left is across your bike lane.
At the intersections you're referring to, that's correct. A lot of times it's a matter of the lesser of the two evils, where usually it's best to position a bike lane where there are fewer conflicts and fewer driveways. So that's something we'll look into that. FDOT's recommendation was on the west side.
Mm-hmm.
We'll corroborate that just to make sure, because it's a good point, but there are going to be conflicts regardless of whether it's on the east side or the west side. I think in this case, it was both sides were evaluated and just determined that the west side would have fewer conflicts and possibly safer.
Okay, so can we wrap this up?
Yeah, just one last question. What are you going to put to divide the bike lane street? Is it going to be like the armadillos? Is it going to be poles?
I think that's undetermined. Yeah,
that's correct. Okay. We still need to go through this.
Got it.
All right, so bring it back in April, and we'll move on to item 26.
Item number 26 has a time frame for 10:30, and it is a transportation item. It is to discuss the raised rumble strips recently installed on Collins Avenue between 5700 block and 5875 block by the Florida Department of Transportation as part of the current resurfacing, restoration, and rehabilitation project on State Road A1A Collins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the issue of speeding, reckless driving along our major thoroughfares, particularly along Collins Avenue, has been something that's been a topic of discussion for some time. As a matter of fact, over a year ago now, it was discussed at this committee, and at that time, the committee recommended that we approach FDOT and push forward safety countermeasures that would mitigate speed. There was a perception of a lot, you know, just car speeding, particularly at nighttime along that stretch. So we approached FDOT. At that time, FDOT let us know that they had an upcoming project, which has now, as we speak, been completed, but at that time, it was still a proposed project. And it was an opportunity to incorporate some speeding countermeasures as part of that project. And so typically, when we refer to speeding countermeasures, we're talking about digital speed feedback signs, signage, traffic calming to the extent that it is allowed. However, FDOT does not allow traffic calming on its major arterials, particularly along evacuation routes like A1A, Collins Avenue. So FDOT heard our concerns, and then they proposed several countermeasures, including the digital speed feedback signs, advisory curve ahead signs. Because in this section of Collins Avenue, as you're traveling north, approaching the 6,000 block, there's a horizontal curve that's pretty pronounced. And so with cars speeding, there's a propensity for those cars to go out of control and hit a building that's actually right there at the 6,000 block. I believe it's called the 6,000 Collins. So that was the concern. So FDOT recommended and actually implemented some of those safety countermeasures, which included rumble strips. So rumble strips are one of those speed deterrents. However, they have the impact that when cars go over them, they make a rumbling noise.
Was the building that the rumble strips placed in front of notified and consulted in advance that they were going to have this in front of their building? Did EFTOC consult the building, telling them that this was coming, or just placed it?
What we've heard from the residents of the Corinthian is that EFTOC did not reach out.
Okay. Can we get public comment?
So first off, we have Patrick. Patrick, are you still here for this item?
Sorry, you're connected.
Oh, no, sorry about that. I'm not.
Next up, we have Will M.
How are you? Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
How are you? My name is Will Mansu. I live at the Corinthians. I'm in apartment 12A. I know he's going to speak now, Fredo is, and I know there's some others, but to answer your question, I never heard about any consulting with the building. I'm one of the board members. I would think that we would have been told, but we didn't. It was just a matter of one day we started hearing noise outside of our apartment, and we all started wondering what it was, and then some of the members in the building decided to call the members of the association and figure it out. So I'll make it short and sweet. It's just really loud. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. They're basically miniature speed bumps, but the problem is people are still driving 35, 40 miles an hour over them, you know? So you're constantly hearing, doo-dum, 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 doo-dum. I mean, it goes on all day long. And I work evenings, so I'll get home at midnight trying to go to bed, and that's all you hear. My kids are to the point where they wear headsets or earphones, you know, whatever, because it really is a nuisance to our building, especially the side, you know, the building that faces west right on the Collins. And we're used to noise. Anybody who's lived on Collins, you know, you're going to hear cars, motorcycles, things, but the constant, you know, it is a constant sound of cars just passing over at a 25 to 35, 40 miles an hour. It is pretty bad.
Thank you, Will. Alfredo?
For the record, Alfredo Gonzalez, representing myself. And I'm also a resident of Corinthian at 5825 Collins Avenue. And just to echo the same concern, just the rumble strips went on right before Thanksgiving. And since then, they've created an incredible noise nuisance. It's not reducing traffic. Anyone, welcome anyone to go out there and see. There are other countermeasures that have been employed, like reducing the speed to 20 miles an hour. That's there on the lanes. Signs to slow down. But the building does echo the concerns about traffic, but it's not slowing down traffic, and it's creating at all hours of the night. My condo faces the ocean, so I'm the furthest away from the street, yet I can sit in bed at night on my iPhone, and I can hear the rumble strips through my hurricane windows. So, wow.
I went on Friday night about 11 o'clock, and I went over the rumble strips like three times over, and I could definitely hear the noise. I also went at the recommendation of a resident down Pine Tree Drive, where rumble strips had been placed all down that street, and they've all been removed because the homes had complained about the noise. I'd like to hear from my colleagues if you've gone out there and have anything. Vice Chair Flores.
Are there any other options besides these tiny rumble strips that don't actually slow down traffic and just make noise that can be swapped
digital
out?
Signs.
Well, can we swap them out with maybe a table that doesn't make noise? The larger tables.
A speed table. So
yeah, it actually forces the drivers to slow down.
Correct. And we've installed those different neighborhoods around the street. However, they're only allowed on local residential streets, not on a major. FDOT does not allow traffic calming speed tables on near major causeways, highways, roadways.
And so right now, as I understand it, it's FDOT's requiring us to pay for the removal.
That's correct.
And what's that cost?
It's about $12,000 to remove all the rumble strips that are in.
Well, I'm in favor of this, and
of the removal?
Yeah.
I am too, especially because there's no evidence that the board was even consulted before placing all of these noisy things in front of their building. Commissioner Magazine.
Yeah, of course, in favor of moving this, it doesn't seem like a deterrent. I'd be interested in seeing if you're able to use your relations to work with FDOT on alternatives I understand the challenge of it being a state road, so we could be limited by the options there. But we can't have something that is providing minimal benefit but causing maximum damage to our residents. So, one, in favor of removing these, and then two, hopeful that we can find some sort of better guided alternative.
And there's more public comments.
We have three more public comments. If we could hear Otto Izquierdo, if you could please unmute yourself. You have 2 minutes.
Otto? Yeah, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good morning. My name is Otto Izquierdo, and I'm the president of the 5825 Association. First of all, thank you to Commissioner Davis Suarez for bringing this on, taking on this, and also special thanks for Commissioner Laura Dominguez for actually coming out here on the time and looking at this and seeing what we have been dealing with for the last 3.5 months. I'm just going to express, I have sent emails to you guys explaining this in detail, but I just want to mention quickly, Will and Alfredo have explained the top five complaints that I have received from many residents. The rumble strips have created loud, disturbing noise, basically 24/7. It is extremely difficult to sleep at night with this noise. We have some residents that are even using earplugs to be able to deal with the noise. Some residents have actually closed their shutters during this time to be able to do this, even if they have impact windows and they can still hear the noise. And then also you can't even go out to your balcony because of the loud noise all the time. So these are just some of the complaints and some of the issues. And like Laura mentioned, I have put in my email, this was the same thing that happened in Pine Tree, and they were actually had to be removed. And, you know, when this has been going on now for 3.5 months. So I want to thank you for taking on this, and hopefully we can get a quick resolution. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Otto.
If we could unmute Rich. Rich, you have 2 minutes. Rich, if you could please unmute yourself, you'll have 2 minutes to speak.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I also live at the 5825 Corinthian, and I am also in the back like Alfredo, and I have impact windows, and I'm up 12 floors, and I can also still hear coming through the building from the road at night, the noise, it just like it keeps going. Fortunately, my bedroom's on the other side. I don't hear it as bad, but if I'm in the living room or on the balcony, I can definitely hear the noise coming from the street. And it's just, I see that most of you seem to be in favor of taking this and going another route, which I appreciate that, because the building was not notified. Because if there was, I can guarantee you there would have been 138 units represented there to prevent this, because we knew what was happening on Pine Tree in the past, and there was no reason to think it would be any worse for us, or not any worse, any better, because our road, Collins, as you know, is a lot busier. And those road bumps, they do no purpose at all. I leave for work in the mornings anywhere from 1:30 to 3, and I see these sports cars, they come racing down the road, and so those bumps, it's not even like they're there. So please, I implore of you to remove the speed bumps. Thank you.
Thank you. And then we have one last caller, Elizabeth Latone.
Okay.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking this up. I live at 6515 Collins, and I am also, or well, my whole neighborhood actually, up to 71st and 72nd are subjected to the racing. It's really incredible. I'm in favor of removing those rumble strips also, but we've got to come up with some sort of a solution to this, because other than having them put maybe in front of the vacant Deauville, which is across from businesses, for a temporary measure that could possibly stop them. I don't know, but something has to be done. And we're also really in favor of safety. And a lady was killed here about 2 years ago in front of the Publix. So I don't know what can be done, but we'd like some help also. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. And I know that the Corinthian has also been in touch with the Mid Beach Neighborhood Association on this item. And I think Commissioner Fernandez has a comment.
Yes. So, you know, clearly, you know, this has become a quality of life issue for the rest of us there. So I would support any efforts to remove them. What I would say in the meantime, perhaps we can speak with our police department to see if speeding is an issue. You know, how can we get more enforcement in that part of Collins Avenue? We know after 3 p.m. speeding is not an issue because there's probably some sort of gridlock there after a certain time of the day. But we can identify those hours of the day when there is the most speeding and ask our police department once these strips are removed, if they could consider having more enhanced enforcement and speed in that area. It could help deter. You go by Ball Harbor during certain hours and you don't think speeding because you just know you'll get pulled over. And so maybe, you know, something like that could be done.
Excellent comments. Appreciate that. We're all in favor.
Yep.
Okay, let's move on to item 17.
Madam Chair, if I may real quick, we do want to move very quickly on this. Can the motion include taking this recommendation to the February 21st City Commission meeting for endorsement so we can proceed with the removal of the strips?
Thank you. Madam Chair, I need to run inside quickly. Do you mind taking another item? Because 17 is my item.
Number 17 is yours?
Yes.
Okay. Jose, is that okay?
Yes.
I agreed transportation altogether so he could leave.
I'll be right back.
Okay, so we'll
number four.
Okay, discuss of the potential closure during peak hours of certain city streets and residential areas located immediately north and south of 41st Street between Flamingo Drive and North Bay Road, except for local residents, in an effort to improve traffic conditions in residential neighborhoods as well as pedestrian and bicycle safety.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This item is also sponsored by Commissioner Fernandez.
Okay, no, let's go on to number one, because it has a time certain anyway, and we're behind a little bit. And that is
discuss the schedule of major events taking place at Pride Park and how to better activate Pride Park for the maximum benefit of the city residents, as well as you're combining item 1 and 10,
right,
which is discuss Pride Park and the number of activation dates.
Right, and so these items were old items.
Is that also Alex said?
No, I'm not sure.
One of them is.
So the reason why we have these items is because they were old from last year when, and they hadn't been heard. Hi. And since then, we've had meetings with Palmview, and there's a different direction that we're moving for Pride Park. But before closing out this item, we do need to hear from Economic Development and Raquel.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and Commissioners. Raquel Williams, Assistant City Manager. I'm joined by colleagues in Economic Development, Tourism and Culture, Oakley Park and Recreation, as well as Convention Center Management with us today. So this item has been on the neighborhood's agenda for a while. It's been deferred a few times, and we're very eager to have the conversation about Pride Park and activation. I think this item comes as a result of concerns raised by residents in the neighborhood that we want to do what we can to address this concern, while also ensuring that we create balance in the Convention Center campus, which was not only created and designed to be an economic driver for Miami Beach, but also for the region. So Pride Park is 5.8 acres. It used to be a parking lot, staging area. It was redeveloped as a park, and there are several amenities that are included in the park right now. We're seeing that the shade is increasing in the park with the trees that have recently been added. We have events that do operate in the park on an annual basis. So, for example, the Design Miami event, which is not specifically tied to Miami Beach Convention Center, that is the event with the longest duration in the park. The city recently negotiated a reduction in the number of days from 54 to 50 days. And we also have the boat show, which is activating beginning today, actually, with the first day of the show. We typically rely on the special event permit process in terms of activations at Pride Park. So if there is an event that is occurring inside of the convention center that is taking up a large amount of space at the convention center and would like to expand, they would go through the special event permitting process in order to activate Pride Park. So it is not that all events that occur in the convention center would automatically have the ability to go into Pride Park, and there is a special event permitting process that would allow for that. So currently we have, for fiscal year 2024, we have 71 days of activation for what we consider commercial events or events that would require a ticket. We also have the Pride Picnic that will be for 2 days, so that will bring the total to 73 days of activation. We also consider that we have to repair the park after the Design Miami event, and that typically takes anywhere from 10 to 14 days, give or take. So some of the concerns from the residents that have been brought to our attention include wanting to have more activities at the park, more activations that are resident and community friendly. And we are planning to put those events together with our Parks and Rec department, as well as Tourism and Culture, to create activations that are more in alignment with what the community is seeking to have. We did do a survey recently. There were 25 respondents from the neighborhood. So we have an idea of the types of activations that are desirable. We also looked at utilization at the park, seeing how many people are there every hour during a period of time last year, where we saw that people use it for their leisure or walking their dog. We looked at the time of day that people utilize the park. And so what we would like to propose is to have balance in the park. We recognize that there are community needs that are not currently being met, and we would like to have an opportunity to activate the park multiple times a year to have more community activations. Right now, Pride Park is one of several parks in the city that is restricted to 120 days of activation. As I mentioned before, we're tracking at 73 days for this fiscal year, and so there's still room for more activation, but we don't see that any other event would possibly go into the park this year. But again, that's set by policy, so our special event guidelines, those are approved by commission, and so the commission did authorize for 120 days, or up to 120 days in Pride Park, among other parks in the city. So this is certainly a discussion that, again, we're very eager to have, because we would love to have a policy direction on how we move forward with Pride Park. We have been very satisfied with OBG 360, the Convention Center Management Team, and their oversight of Pride Park. They do utilize a city vendor, a third-party vendor, to help maintain the park. We do have checks and balances in place where we oversee what they are doing in the park, and we have been satisfied. However, there's always room for improvement. We are currently in the process of negotiating an agreement with OBG 360 for their continued management of the Convention Center campus, and we would like to get the direction today that will help inform that negotiation process.
I'd like to check with my colleagues. Do you want to hear from the public first or a comment?
I think I'd like to hear from the public first.
Okay. We have people here in person.
From Palmview, by David.
Hello, David Greaser. I'm resident of Palmview. I live right across the street, overlooking Pride Park. Thank you guys for taking this item. Very much appreciate it. When this park was being created, city staff actually came and visited our condo. They sat with us. We had drinks and snacks, and we looked out over the park, and we talked about the details.
What year was it?
This was 2017, I would say. And it was promised to us this would be a park that was for residents, primarily for residents, with one exception, which was to allow the Design Miami to go in, because Design Miami had decided that they couldn't fit into the ballroom that was created for them at the convention center. There's also explicitly promised that this park would be under the jurisdiction of Parks and Rec, and it would be utilized as part of Parks and Rec's inventory to serve residents. At this point in time, Pride Park closes every year about October 20th, and it's functionally closed through mid-March. There's like a 10-day period where the grass is sort of regrowing in between the boat show and the beginning of the end of Design Miami and then the beginning of the boat show. But we think that we really need to swing this back to be a resident-focused park, which is what was originally promised very explicitly. You can actually go through meeting testimony
where it was said by city staff and board members that that was what the intention was. And all of my neighbors were at those meetings objecting to how the park was visualized. It was originally promised to our neighborhood in 2014 as entirely a 100% park. If you look at those original drawings, was not optimized for events. It was not a field set up to be a fairgrounds. In reality, we feel like it has really sort of drifted in that direction. It's 6 acres. 6 acres are in the center of the city. We're Barrier Island. We are always, you know, desperate for space to do things. So we think this 6 acre space could be much more valuably used, you know, with children's playground equipment, padel courts. I know the Parks and Rec Department is looking for a spot to put a padel court, more pickleball courts, all sorts of activations that residents could really use. If you looked at the recent survey that they did, it shows, you know, during the day, essentially nobody uses the park. Now, there's very limited shade, and outside of the gym, which is somewhat well used, there's nothing to do in the park. So I really think that's evidence that this is a missed opportunity. And it's not what was originally promised to us. So thank you all again. Much appreciated.
Thank you, David. Anybody on the phone? We can alternate phone.
Yes. We have two callers. We have John Courtney.
Okay.
Caller.
Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. Thank you guys for hearing this issue. I think we're all sort of on the same page here with what Dave has already shared around the history and sort of the broken promises. But I just wanted to address the OBG management and this relationship of economic development, hiring out a private company to manage a public park. And I think, unfortunately, the result is that this is just the worst run, least activated park in our city. And it's 5.8 acres in the center of our city. And it's just really unfortunate that that's where we have arrived. And I think, as much as I, you know, appreciate Raquel's good intentions here, you just can't have a private company who's more interested in profit and reducing costs, optimizing a park for the public. And so I think there's not really an opportunity to move forward there, and that this does need to move to the Parks Department. I also think it's important for everyone to recognize that we're not asking for a change here. We're just asking staff to live up to the promises that were made. And we're asking the commissioners to direct staff to transfer the management to the Parks Department and to stop holding conventions in the park altogether. So I appreciate you all discussing this item today.
Anybody else in person want to be addressed?
Alberto Poncha, I live in Pampio for 23 years. The park, you know, it should be, I don't know, for the people that are right there. I think this is being issues a little bit. We can have some events, but not all the time. I mean, traffic gets horrible or whatever. And for us, it's just not a good thing.
Thank you, Alvaro. Anybody else on Zoom?
We have one more caller on Zoom, Patrick.
Hi, Patrick.
Hi, thanks for taking this point again. My name is Patrick Breschick. I live across the street from Pride Park. Currently looking at billboards for progressive insurance. Right now, the park, from the pedestrian perspective, is just billboards for advertisements for the boat show sponsors. And it's really not a public space like the rest of our parks are. So I would encourage you to give the management of this public space back to the Parks Department because they do such a great job in our other areas. They've really increased the space on top of the parking garage is now some pickleball courts, which is really great and used, which has been, you know, we have about 40 people that play there on the weekends, which it was currently, or before that, it was just an empty parking lot with a few city parking cars, city parked cars. So I would just encourage everyone to please give this back to the Parks Department and make it a resident-focused area again. Thank you.
Madam Chair, may I ask?
Yes, Vice Chair.
May I ask a question before?
Of course.
The caller, Patrick, brings up a good point on general prohibition on advertising signs. So, you know, because this was brought to my attention on an email, is there language that says we're allowed to have advertising on the parks, I guess, during these big events?
Sure. Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members, Dice Adrogante, Director of Tourism and Culture for the City of Miami Beach. So there is language, and can state that directly in our code, Section 12-5 for special event permits. The second line says a special event is defined as a temporary use on public or private property that would not be permitted generally or without restriction throughout a particular zoning district, but would be permitted if controlled with a special review in accordance with this section. But that leads me to our special event guidelines. On section E of the guidelines regarding event signage, it says sponsorship, banners, and signage are allowed with the designated event site only and may be displayed only during the event. Banners must be immediately removed from the site following the event. And so with large-scale events that we have, like in Queens Park and Pride Park, it's customary for them to have signage, temporary signage, you know, with their event sponsorship. So during the special event review process, we take special attention. We look at controversial subject matter, you know, obviously anything that's offensive, gambling, alcohol, you know, that type of, you know, substances that we would not allow. But as far as sponsors, if you go to any event, see Goya, you know, anything, it's nothing offensive.
So I'm reading it. This says the special public event sponsor shall be responsible for providing acceptable proof of insurance and indemnification. The name of a company or product providing sponsorship may be prominent feature of the sign.
Yes.
However, is that, I guess that's the provision?
Yes.
But there's like, I mean, because I live across the street in Bright Park, there's,
sure.
I mean, the whole fence is basically an advertising, maybe with sections of green in between. So who's to decide how many signs there are? How many signs of advertising?
There's no specific direction of how many signs you can have. If you look at the sign, it does include also QR codes that have directional mapping, where to get tickets, and it does have some breaks in between with some greenery imagery and like, there's no specific number that, to answer your question, there's no number specific of how many logos you can have.
Yeah, because it says, you know,
it's
a product providing maybe a prominent feature of the sign. However, general advertising signs are not permitted. So where it says, however, general advertising signs are not permitted, that's in section E. So how does that jive with each other?
So the special event permit would allow for that, the temporary signage, which includes that.
Interesting.
Commissioner Fernandez.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, for calling this item. I placed this item on the agenda because this is a good opportunity to look at the number of activation days. When we look at our special events guidelines, there's areas of our city where we've set a 120-day cap for special event activations. And as it's described in the memorandum, it includes areas like the Loomis Park beachfront, Collins Avenue, the Collins Avenue corridor, Ocean Terrace. What I find unique in those areas is that those are the MXE zoned areas of our city, the areas of our city for mixed-use entertainment districts. Those are the areas that perhaps are more are better suited for traditionally, historically, for this type of activity. Once you go further inland and more into the residential areas of our city, such as Pride Park, you're surrounded by residential multifamily zoning right at its periphery. And then you go into more residential zoning further in, which is why it's worthy of further analysis to consider whether this specific park should have more limited activation days than other parks, because it is further into our residential areas in the city. As part of this item, I'm also concerned that that not only are we currently allowing up to 120 days of activation in a fiscal year in Pride Park when it's so close to residentially sold property, but I'm further concerned that at some point we're gonna have the Grand Hyatt Hotel built, and I'm concerned that once that's built, there could potentially be a bigger demand for activation days on Pride Park, which will ultimately affect the quality of life of the residents that live around Pride Park and limit the general public's use of Pride Park. With that in mind, I'd like for the committee to consider making a recommendation to perhaps reduce the number of activation days in Pride Park. Maybe a maximum of 75 days might be prudent. That way we can still accommodate the Miami International Boat Show. That way we can still accommodate Design Miami, but also still accommodate the residential use of the park, still accommodate the quality of life of our residents. And additionally, I'd like for us to consider designating an area on the western edge, of the park that remains free of activation, so that the residents not only have an area that they can use, but they also have a buffer, a little bit of an added buffer from the activations that go in the park. So that's part of the material that I'd like for the committee to consider in its recommendation to the city commission. I think it's one of the things that we can do to make sure that there is a good relationship between the convention center, which this park is a part of the convention center facilities, but it maintains a good relationship with a neighboring residence.
Okay, Commissioner Magazine.
Yeah, I guess where I'm going with this is I just think we need to do a better job of striking that proper balance. I think if we put a hard, fast stop on, seems like we're kind of right up against the number of activation days right now. No, the proposed, like, 75.
Right. That would preclude us from using the park for those unticketed, open, free community activations. If we were to program the park beyond the existing ticketed activations, we would hit a wall.
And maybe, John, if you could answer this, sorry to catch you off guard here, but 6 acres, that's, absent the golf courses and Flamingo Park, the largest park that we have in our city?
It's on the larger side, but yes, absent the Loomis North Beach Ocean Side Park, it's the larger one.
I mean, looking at an aerial map, it's amongst the least dense residential areas here. You are bordered by several multifamily buildings just on the west, but absent that, then your boundaries are the convention center, the botanical garden, Miami Beach City Hall. I think that's a large reason why we're not seeing a lot of activation. And when we talk about, well, maybe we see more utilization of the park if we activated it, that would be a hard balance to strike, because all of a sudden, if we're sitting there building children's playgrounds, I'm the father of a six-year-old, I think we have plenty of opportunity to expand utilizations like that. But there wouldn't allow for any activation during Art Basel or the boat show or things like that. If we have padel courts, those aren't mobile. You can't pick those up during Art Basel or Design Miami and say, okay, we're moving a children's playground, right? It's somewhat of an all or nothing in terms of utilization. So it does seem as if the option here is to either have this as a fully active utilized park with playgrounds and padel courts, or to have it as a passive park that is able to strike this kind of better balance.
Right. Children's playground, you're not going to pick that up. However, pickleball, padel courts can be constructed in a way that they can go up and down, but not children's playgrounds. Some of these other amenities, picnic shelters, trees, obviously.
And from your professional viewpoint, are there ways where we're kind of leaving some low-hanging fruit on the table about how to turn around the activation to returning it to our quote-unquote residential park? So the re-sodding, are there things that we could explore that will essentially accelerate that process? This is not my expertise, but instead of having to re-sod every time, put down some sort of a rubber ground. That's obviously not a real solution, but things along those lines where we can essentially become more efficient at the turnaround time from activating this park for commercial venues to returning it to what the park's intended for.
Right. We have not explored those options outside of natural sod, which you see the time to make that happen. However, we've directed, so we've never looked at those different options.
Vice Chair?
I think we should not lose sight of the fact that, you know, a lot of the previous callers have stated that what was sold to them in the community is one thing, and what they got is something completely different. You know, I live across the street, Pride Park, and it is probably the least resident friendly part in the city. You know, the center of the park has this mixed match of grass and then concrete walkway. And so if you wanted to run your dog, for example, or you run yourself with your dog, you're gonna trip over concrete and then going back onto grass. And not to mention that in the heat of the summer, there's literally no shade at all in the center of the park. And that's the majority of the area. It certainly seems like that park isn't really a park. It's more of like a staging ground for events. And so what I have a problem with is, you know, I've watched the history recordings on this subject, and the way it was promised to the residents is not what it is now. And I know you don't run the park, right? Parks Department doesn't run Pride Park. It's OVG.
Right, correct. We provide professional oversight to assist contract management.
Okay. And then, you know, like maybe a month ago after the Design Miami, I was walking my dog and there was this oily film substance on the sidewalk or on the, I guess, the rotunda. And it was there for like a week until I had to call and say, hey, you know, this is still filthy. And next day it was clean, but it certainly seems that no one is really paying attention to detail at that park. And what is there now isn't very, I guess, resident friendly. And look, I understand it's the least dense part of the city in terms of residential. However, you know, there is a large community. I mean, there's Palmview, and then there's Bayshore. You know, there's going to be on Meridian just north of there. So, you know, I think, you know, to be frank, I have an item on this upcoming meeting, and I don't know if I can speak on that item today. It kind of dovetails exactly with this
report. Where do you want to go with this one?
I'm going to hear what
Stefan.
Rest of my colleagues have to say about this.
Sorry, I don't want to repeat anything. I'm Stefan Chines. I'm a resident on Michigan Avenue. I'm also the president of Palmview. I don't want to repeat anything that was said so far, and I agree with that. And I really appreciate also that all of you have shown a very strong interest in helping out on this situation. The only thing I would like to add is, like, I think we're here today simply because some opportunities were missed before. And I'm just not going back in time. But for example, when the contract came up for renewal for Design Miami, we were not informed about this. The reason why we found out is because John, who was on the call, was able to find these items in the consent agenda. And we were able to ask you to pull that item so we could at least be able to be part of the discussion. So if this would have happened, the Design Miami renewal would have gone through with no discussion at all. We had finally a discussion with this with staff, and it was kind of a more listening discussion. We were told that, hey, Design Miami doesn't have anything with this, and please let it go through. We did, because we are nothing to do. We have nothing against the Design Miami. We have nothing against the boat show. But enough is enough. After that, let's not add some more to this. That discussion never happened. We're in February. This was discussed in September. We've never heard back from staff. Just want to bring up also some other situation that happened where I don't think that the management of the park is done in the best possible way right now. When they resodded after the Design Miami, this was done and almost finished on December 31st. And because the two workers were not going to work during the weekend, so we went through New Year's Eve and you know, that big weekend with the sod not being finished. That event was the first week of December. So at the end of December, so technically by January 1st, the sodding was not finished. because nobody's pushing, nobody's supervising. Like Commissioner Suarez said, he had to intervene to talk about this. Why isn't this cleaned up? I want to bring up another example. We have, and you pay for a beautiful restroom facility that has always been closed. We're unable to manage and have a park with a restroom facility. Some other parks are pushing to have restrooms, like we're talking about at Alton Road and Fifth. We have them, and they've been closed all the time. I couldn't tell you what it looks like inside. This is getting to a point where we're really concerned about this. So because this is saying beating out of it.
Okay, I think we need to close out this item because it's been on for a year, and well, Vice Chair Suarez has an item at the next commission meeting on this topic for us to review.
I just wanted to ask for an opportunity to give some clarification, and we also do have the general manager of the convention center here with us. Commissioner Suarez, to your point about the issue with Assad, you did bring that, you did forward an email, and I did let you know that it was already scheduled to be repaired and replaced. So that didn't happen as a result of your communication, but it was already scheduled. I think one of the missteps that we had in that moment was not having some signage out to say, hey, this is still being, you know, repaired and replaced and, you know, basically part of our dust. And I think that's what we can do better going forward. I do want to, if you would allow our general manager of the convention center to come forward, if you would like, if not.
One minute. Fred.
Good morning, commissioners. Good morning, general public. My name is Freddie Peterson. I privately manage the Miami Beach Convention Center and its campus on behalf of the city of Miami Beach. I do want to say, as a resident, by the way, I really appreciate the commissioners and the city for all that we do on behalf of the residents. Point well taken. There's always room for improvement. I really appreciate the feedback. We do have a contractor, SFM Landscaping, that we work with through the city of Miami Beach on taking any corrective measures as soon as possible when they identify. It is a bit of a tricky balancing act. We've said that term a couple of times here today. When you're talking about resodding or power washing, et cetera, it does take a little bit of time because you're also looking at the underground utility damages, et cetera. So we are pushing the landscaping contractor to mobilize a lot quicker, to finish in that space a lot quicker. And then also the power washing, again, Commissioner Suarez had mentioned that, and I've even seen it myself, much more aggressive on the power washing side of things when it comes to the sidewalks and those spaces, not only to SFM Landscaping, because it's built into their contract to do that at least 4 times a year, but even our staff. So again, taking more of an initiative and a more aggressive approach, if you will, in this part of this project. So, I don't know if there's any questions through the chair, anybody else that I can, provide some additional feedback. And again, working through the city, with the community, with the neighborhood, the residents, I'm more than happy to strike that balance, as we keep saying here, when it comes to this space, options.
Vice Chair?
I don't want to take too much more time on this. I know you're ready to move on. I think, like I said, I have an item on the 21st to discuss this, and I wanted to check everyone's temperature on this. I'm glad Alex is here. You know, what I would propose is, you know, we have two events that are a longstanding tradition in my boat show, right, which is right now, and Design Miami. How would my colleagues feel if we capped it at only those two events, and any other future events that we want to do just has to go through a regulatory process where it has community input, maybe comes to the neighborhoods committee, and then you know, start the transition from a commercial park to a real residential park.
100%, because I have looked at the videos as well. The park was never intended to be a commercial or part of the campus of the convention center. I understand that it was a parking lot before, but every committee and commission meeting discussion said that this was a park for the residents. So anything moving forward would have to go through the Palmview neighborhood to see if it's acceptable to them. And I'd like to move on.
Madam Chair, if I may. Mayor? Thank you. That's exactly the intent of this item. It hasn't been on committee for a year, Madam Chair. It's been here since September. I made the referral September 13, 2023, and the purpose of the referral, and I quote, was to further define a more resident accessible policy for Pride Park, and specifically for this committee to consider whether amendments may be appropriate to reduce the amount of special event activation days while continuing to accommodate signature events such as Design Miami and the Boat Show. And I asked the committee to place reasonable limits on days that Pride Park can be used as an event space. I think based on the feedback that we've received today, I think we should make a recommendation that event activation days be limited to no more than that 75 days, that there be space designated for residential use even when you have activations, so that residents are not completely blocked from the park when Boat Show is there or when Design Miami is there.
I think there's caps already right now, aren't there?
It's 120 days. Okay. And that was my point earlier. 120 days is what we have in the mixed-use entertainment district. But this is the heart of our residential area. This is bordered by RM2 zoning. And then you go further in, you have residential single-family zoning. And then you cross Dade Boulevard, and whenever you have an activation there, the people whose quality of life are being impacted are the residents of Palmview and the residents of
State Shore. What's in the contract for Design Miami and the Boat Show? Is it less than 120?
So it's 50 days in the Design Miami contract. The Boat Show activation days are 21 days. So this fiscal year, we're looking at ticketed events at 71 days.
Okay, and what Commissioner Fernandez is saying is fair. How do you guys feel about it, the rest of the committee?
I mean, yes, but there has to be some sort of process where it can't just be a hard limit where it has to be the economic development team or the convention center would come and say, hey, we have this signature event. We just heard today, Commissioner Fernandez, Boca brings $30 billion of economic activity to our region. So those are very real numbers. So yes, let's be sure that we're not just opening the floodgates for anything. And I agree that we need to essentially be more resident focused on this. We can roll back that cap, but there has to be some sort of, I don't want to say appeals process, but some sort of way where Raquel and the convention center team can come in and run it through a committee where the committee is actually tasked with going out and reaching out to Palmview and saying, hey, we're going to start this process of working together with you, because parks are great. I think having the Design Miami and the Boat Show in our backyards are also great. So we wouldn't want to miss out on the next signature event with a hard and fast rule. So let's really engage the community.
And I think through the chair to my colleague's point, certainly, you know, we always establish caps, but the city commission always has the authority that if there's, you know, a one-off event that we desire to approve, that can always be approved by the city commission. And so I would encourage the committee to recommend a 75-day cap, that anything outside of that, you know, you have someone's party or you have a one-day volleyball tournament, that it be able to be brought to the city commission for approval by the city commission. But these 75 other days of activation, that doesn't require city commission approval. But once you hit that cap and you have this you know, one-off event, okay, we bring that to the city commission. If it's reasonable, we approve it. And if it's not reasonable, we don't approve it. And perhaps one of the things that we can do to ensure proper notification to the residents is that we make that type of item a resident's right to know item, so that the abutting associations, whether it be Palmview, Bayshore, or even Cullens Park, so that they're notified of this. So I would urge the committee to make that, open up the bathrooms as part of the recommendation. And the last thing that I would ask is, let's ask the Parks Department to study what type of temporary shade structure could be installed in the park, so that when the park is not being activated with special events, the residents have some sort of shade there, because it does get very, they were playing their pickleball once. I went there once. It was just too hot.
Okay, so now to close this out, so the recommendation will be to open up the park for 75 days. This will go back to the commission.
You mean limit,
and then the bathrooms.
You mean limit from 120 to 75.
Limit from 120 to 75, and then open up the bathrooms.
For clarification, are those 75 days for ticketed activations, or if Parks and Rec or Tourism and Culture?
Ticketed.
Okay, so if there are events open to the public that are community-centered events, they would not fall within that 75.
Tom, how do you feel?
We're okay, as long as there's a process that is approved, that is going through the commission, like the commissioner recommended, we have no problem. We want to be informed and
right.
Have plenty of time to look at.
Are we okay, committee, with that?
The only thing with the bathroom is, I would caution, the bathrooms are closed for a reason, I'm assuming. And right now, are those bathrooms controlled by OVG or Parks Department?
They're controlled by OVG, and they have been closed due to public safety issues related to homeless. And we've shared that publicly before at a prior meeting. We could explore having the bathrooms open for a certain time period of day. There would be a physical impact, and we could relay that to the commission.
Well, what I was going to say is, I think Parks runs a pretty good operation on when to close bathrooms and when to open it. So I don't necessarily want to, I don't know if I want OVG determining when bathrooms should be open or closed. So maybe we should let staff come back with recommendations.
Sounds good.
On the bathroom, because that can open a whole can of worms.
100%.
And the city would tell OVG when we want the bathrooms open. We have contract oversight. Parks and Rec is very much included in that as well.
Okay.
So we could always direct them.
Do you have that, Stephanie?
So I have the items concluded.
Okay.
We're going to recommend the limiting the days.
Thank you.
Going back, and you have an item on the 21st.
Can we go back to number 17? And that's Commissioner Fernandez's item.
You and I are going to be the prolific item.
I don't know if I have anything.
I'm also
this meeting. Well, these are okay. So, Madam Chair, I place this item on the agenda because with the implementation of the Better Bus Networks, we've seen an elimination. An elimination of certain routes. One of the discontinued routes was route 115, and route 115 provided southbound service from North Beach all the way down towards Alter Road and towards Mount Sinai. It also provided service from Lincoln Road and Washington Avenue to Mount Sinai as well. What's ended up happening is that it's made it more difficult for individuals who live in North Beach who want to access Mount Sinai. It's also made it more difficult, let's say, for individuals who live in North Beach who want to access the Airport Express bus. These are important connections. Mount Sinai is not only a medical facility, it's one of our major employers here in Miami Beach. 41st Street is a center of commerce in our city. And not giving our residents a route that connects them to Route 115 that provides that Airport Express connection not only hurts our residents, but also hurts the individuals who work in our businesses. Because a lot of the people who take the Airport Express, that 150 route, are not just people leaving Miami Beach, but they're individuals who take that bus route to come into Miami Beach and then need a connection to get from there to North Beach and other places of employment. And so I made this referral to see how we could expand that connectivity, perhaps some realignment of existing trolley routes during certain peak hours, so that we can reestablish that connection between North Beach and Mount Sinai and the Miami Beach Airport Express bus.
Excellent point. I've heard from many residents in North Beach and actually even in South Beach as well,
yep,
that can't get to Mount Sinai because the bus that used to go on Alton for West Avenue residents was eliminated, and now they have to walk to Washington, and taking the South Beach loop hasn't been an option for them to get there. But anyway, the point here is North Beach, and our Director of Transportation, Jose, is here to talk more.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. Jose Gonzalez, Transportation and Mobility Director, for the record. So as we mentioned, on November 13th, the county initiated the Better Bus Network. And as of that date, November 13th, we launched an expanded on-demand freebie service that serves the portion in North Beach that was previously served by Route 150. We had various discussions with the county in terms of what the right vehicle should be, how many vehicles. Initially, we proposed two vehicles. Let me take a step back. Initially, we actually proposed our trolley service. We then proposed, and to which the county did not support that idea. We then proposed an on-demand type of service, and the county was more receptive to a first mile, last mile solution. We proffered two additional vehicles to try to satisfy the demand. The county agreed to only one, and they memorialized that in a letter that they sent to us back on October 11th of last year. That they, in fact, the letter is titled "Enhanced Freebie Service," because that would be the only option that the county would support. And then the county moved forward with an interlocal agreement, which went to the city commission for approval for one additional vehicle that the county would pay for. That additional vehicle was placed into service on November 13th, the same day that the Route 115 was eliminated, when the Better Bus Route was implemented, and we've been tracking ridership since that date. And what we've found is that during the off-peak times, the demand is satisfied. The additional vehicle does well during the non-peak times. However, during the peak times, morning rush and afternoon rush, when people are trying to get to the hospital, because they work there, and then in the afternoons trying to get back home, that is when we've been seeing wait times reaching up to 1 hour, reaching up to 60 minutes, which we all know is not acceptable. So,
and Jose, what's the recommendation?
So one of the things we wanted to do was share with the county this data. Now that since November 13th, we've been collecting this data. So we wanted to share this with them because we think collaboratively we could come up with a better solution. Whether that solution is to add more on-demand, more freebie vehicles, or some sort of an option where our trolleys can potentially be realigned, we would need to discuss that with them. Because even the trolley option, they would need to approve, particularly if they're funding. And at the end of the day, we're going to need an agreement with them. So they would need to be supportive of whatever option we decide.
So the recommendation here is to provide the analysis for an expanded freebie?
Well, and Madam Chair, I'm not sure if expanding freebie during peak hour would be sufficient. I think perhaps during, non-peak hours, freebie might be fine. The problem is during peak hours, we know wait times are up to 1 hour. Of the individuals who know that the freebie is there, because there might be individuals who go to the bus stop who might not even know that that there's a freebie option. And so this is of the customers that know that we have a freebie service, and that peak hour, the wait hours are up to 1 hour. And there might be a whole segment of consumers.
So virtually, I don't understand what the recommendation is.
Well, the freebie is a car, and I don't think a car is really what we need during peak hours. We need to encourage individuals to use public transit, and I don't think we're going to achieve that during peak hours with a freebie. I would like for us to explore what expanded trolley service we can provide during peak hours. You know, reach out to the county, certainly share with them this data. Certainly wait times of up to 1 hour during peak time, I don't think achieves the efficiencies that the Better Bus Network was seeking to achieve. And the most important thing for the success of any plan like this is adaptation. We implement something and we hope it'll be successful and we'll achieve the goals that we aim to achieve. But we have to be willing and able to adapt to what the implementation tells us is necessary in order to be successful. And so I would reach out to the county, share the data with them, let them know our request of possibly expanding the trolley service during the peak hour so we can better reduce that 1 hour wait time.
Excellent. Do we have public comment?
We do not.
Okay. I am in favor of that recommendation. What do my colleagues feel?
Of course, it's an
information. Okay, yeah. Let's close this one out. That's number 17. Number 4.
Number 4 was deferred. So was
deferred. Okay. Yeah.
You're deferring number 4?
Yes. I thought I had
number 4. You're deferring number 25.
Why? Yeah. Why was it deferred? I thought at one point we had already discussed this at committee. And I think the old committee didn't feel comfortable with this idea. Certainly if this committee feels more... But I think if you guys want
to talk about that,
yeah.
Okay, let's do it.
Let's bring it up.
Okay, so number 4.
Yes.
You need to call the item.
I will call the item. Item number 4, discussion of potential closure during peak hours of certain city streets and residential areas located immediately north and south of 41st Street between Flamingo Drive and North Bay Road, except for local residents in an effort to improve traffic conditions in residential neighborhoods as well as pedestrians and bicyclists' safety.
And
Commissioner Fernandez, this is your item.
Yeah, I'll tell you. There's gridlock. There are certain periods of the year after 3 p.m. There's total gridlock in throughout our city, and you see it worse in residential neighborhoods where individuals can't back out of their driveways. They can't exit their homes. They feel trapped in their homes. You know, this item, I brought forward this item at the time to see, okay, is there anything that we can limit the amount of cut-through traffic? You know, a lot of times you see trucks, you see construction workers, you see deliveries cutting through these neighborhoods. And it's very frustrating to those residents who not only are trapped in their homes, but individuals trying to get home, and like for me, I live within this area as well. It could take me sometimes 30 minutes to get from City Hall to the corner of Chase and Alton. That's insane. That is insane. I don't know if this necessarily is a solution. I have put it on the agenda last time. I know the last composition of the committee didn't feel comfortable with this idea. It seems like I don't know how this committee might feel about it. I was ready to defer the item, but I would certainly welcome the feedback of my colleagues.
Vice Chair Suarez.
Can I actually just say something first?
Of course.
We have some input on this. And I think this is what happened the last committee discussion of this, too. We sort of closely researched this issue, and there are two Florida Attorney General opinions which are not binding on the city, but they're highly persuasive legal authority that say that the city cannot close a street to residents only. You can, according to Florida statutes, restrict a street for a special occasion, like
during boat show, if everybody was going into a neighborhood, you could close that to residents for a day or two. But to say that at certain times or even for the whole day, every day, that that the street is only going to be open to residents of that street, that has been in two different times the Attorney General has opined that's not contemplated.
Madam Chair, that's exactly what I was going to suggest. I don't know about every day, but I think I'd love to see everyone's temperature on high impact weekends because, you know, we live in the area. And during, for example, Art Basel, I mean, it was, if you couldn't move, and, you know, everyone is trying to take a side street thinking that it's a quicker way, and then the residential neighborhoods get clogged up. Everything's clogged up. So at least keep the residential neighborhoods open. So I'd love to see what everyone would think about during high impact weekends, where we would basically limit that to residential use only, similar how do we do in like South of Fifth
and Palmview. We do it now exactly. For boat showing for our Basel.
So you know, Bayshore, I believe should also be afforded that you know that privilege of having access for residents only during like super high impact weekends.
And Mr. Vice Chair, and north of 41st Street as well. We have neighborhoods north of 41st Street that experience this same traffic. I most certainly do think high impacts, I think, is reasonable. And I think, Rob, that's something that you had brought up at committee last time, that if it's a temporary matter, not a permanent regulation, but a temporary matter during a high. So, like, boat show is considered high impact?
I don't know if it's considered high impact, but it is a time period. And Memorial Day is a time period, which, of course, is high impact. And I think staff could tell you more, but we do that in certain areas. We close off neighborhoods to vehicular traffic, except for residents. And when I lived in Flamingo Park neighborhood, that was done. And so, yes, we could definitely do, whether you want to call it high impact, whether you want to call it just to designate which events you want to do it for, however you want to say it, if it's on a temporary as needed basis for something like a very high impact event, then that would be fine. You just can't do it every day.
Right.
Commissioner Magazine.
Yeah, I just want to be really careful with the unintended consequences here. Fine to try this on some sort of pilot flexible basis, but we have to be very flexible with how we react to this. We don't want to create more problems out of this.
I agree, Vice Chair. Do you have anything else to share?
Yeah, so I guess if we want to explore this further, would we just go back to the transportation and ask them to come back to us with recommendations on specifically the area that Commissioner Fernandez has pointed out during high impact weekends? I'd like to make that.
Can we move it to the commission so we get it out of committee and have them present their recommendation there?
I'll make that motion.
Okay. All in favor?
Madam Chair, if you would allow, if I could just, since this is my item, to continue working with the administration, with the transportation department, maybe identifying those events and this specific geographic area.
Thank you, Commissioner.
For sure.
We'll all right. So now we can move on to number eight.
It's your item.
Okay, we have item number eight is parking. Discussion regarding parking enforcement on bicycle lanes. And Monica Beltran will be presenting the item. I think she is just making her way through our transition rooms.
Hey,
Albert is presenting today.
Good morning, hi, Madam Commissioner. Commissioner Alberto Ventura, Assistant Parking Director. This item was first heard, a brief history of this item. It was first heard on December 22nd, on December 7th of 22. And this committee, this is an item from Commissioner Fernandez who raised concerns of the bike lanes. He requested that we add dedicated personnel to enforce. We have been enforcing since January of 2023. To date, we have issued 275 violations for bike lanes. In addition, we have also issued over 7,000 for vehicles obstructing traffic, which the officer has the discretion to issue either or.
So I'm sorry, can you repeat the numbers again?
For bicycle lane violations, 275.
Right.
For obstructing traffic, 7,074.
Okay. So let me ask you this. What is the best way? Because I think residents a lot of times, you know, see UPS trucks blocking a bicycle lane. Mm-hmm. They'll see a FedEx truck or Amazon. What's the best way for residents to report this when they're seeing this?
They could report it to our parking dispatch, which we're open 24/7. We can provide the phone number that they can call. But we have dedicated officers. When it's a UPS truck, something like that, since those are considered freight vehicles, then instead of issuing one of these two violations, they are issued a right-of-way fine, which is a $500 fine for the person.
Okay. And we have safe routes to schools. For example, Prairie Avenue goes to Manny Beach Senior High, and then we have Nautilus as well and other schools. Do we have dedicated enforcement in certain time periods to ensure that these bicycle lanes are unobstructed when kids are typically going to school or going back home from school?
During the morning, we have at least 1 to 2 officers that we assign to drive through those areas.
Okay. All right.
And we will continue to assign officers and help us.
Thank you, Alberto. So is there a recommendation here?
No, I wanted an update.
Just an update. Wonderful update. Thank you. We're going to close it out and move on to the next item. Okay. I appreciate that.
That's pretty.
Oh, was there any public comment?
We have one public comment caller in user 2.
1 minute.
We could unmute. You have 1 minute, and please announce your name for the record.
Hi, thank you. This is Matthew Galtana. And I want to thank Commissioner Fernandez for bringing this item. I remember when it was heard last year, and as the past chair of the city's Transportation, Parking, and Bicycle Pedestrian Facilities Committee, I worked with Alberto and the parking department to try to help prioritize the enforcement of people who are stopping in bicycle lanes. I have to say that like 270, I think I heard over the last year, is really a low number. When I ride every day around, whether I'm taking my kids to school or going to work or going to the store, I see dozens almost a day people who are stopped in bike lanes. And many times they could have just pulled to the curb and they wouldn't be blocking the bicycle lane. So I think that, with perhaps more direction could be given, maybe more resources allocated to get our bicycle lanes that are on the street, more resources allocated to increase the enforcement and the education as well. It's not just giving a punitive ticket, but it's educating as to why these bicycle lanes need to be kept clear so that they're able to use. You know, these are used by people of all ages, all abilities, and right now, many situations, it's just unsafe. So I appreciate, again, the initiative that's been taken and that maybe it could be stepped up a couple notches. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Matthew. Matthew. So we'll close out this item.
And just a question, because I know we have 4 certified parking enforcement officers assigned to a bicycle unit.
We have more than after this item was first heard, we have like 5 more officers that have certified.
But I've never seen a parking enforcement officer on a bicycle.
Well, normally what they'll do is they'll leave the office in the bike and the bike is on the truck, and then they park and then they'll use the bike.
Okay. How often are they doing this?
Should be daily.
Should be. How often are they doing it? I should, but how often are they doing it?
I will look into it, but it's supposed to be that they're supposed to assign an officer, whether it's on a bike or on a vehicle that they are supposed to assign.
Okay, because that was my request as part of this item was specifically I want to see parking enforcement officers on bicycle lanes throughout the city. We have a lot of city. We should have at any given time always at least one parking enforcement officer on the bicycle lane. So with that,
Thank you, and I agree 100%. Okay, the item is closed. 25.
Right, we have item number 25 was deferred as per Commissioner Fernandez. We're going to listen to item number 5, which is building, discuss the quarterly building update. And we have, I believe, Natasha presenting the item from building.
Hi, good morning, commissioners. Natasha Diaz, Building Department Assistant Director. This item is a quarterly update to inform the commission on any updates or streamlining effort that the building department has made. Today's update will be on the first quarter of this fiscal year and really a little recap of the past whole year, but I'll keep it brief to highlight some impactful ones. In the past year, all the departments involved in the development process, permitting process, have worked together and with an outside consultant to identify bottlenecks and develop improvement strategy. This is an ongoing effort amongst all the departments, and there is an item at the next finance committee to provide the commission with an update on the actions taken from the recommendations from the consultant. Some other items, the building department has improved its online navigation, so working with the communication and the IT web designers to improve the navigation and access of the information online, including updating the 170-plus checklist that we have to make it easier for applicants to find the list of information, plans, and documents they need to submit as part of their submittal. Public outreach, we continue to host monthly training and assistance sessions for the public. It's every third Thursday of the month, so the next one will be tomorrow from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. And we've also supplemented it by adding other departments in the session. So tomorrow we'll have Public Works, and they'll be also providing information on their permitting process and answering questions that the public may have. In 2024, we've started assigning a dedicated permit representative to each permit application that will be the customer's go-to person throughout the life of their application. So up until now, you apply, then you wait and see what happens. And if you get stuck, you haven't really known who to call. So now, as soon as you apply, within about a day, one of our permit representatives will reach out, introduce themselves, share their contact info so that the applicants can call with any questions and concerns. We believe this will assist with reducing the calls to the call centers and other random areas that can't really help them. We've also taken a proactive approach on dedicating a staff member to contact applicants on stagnant applications that have been sitting with no movement for several months. So we started with quality of life type permits like air conditioning and roofing. And so they'll engage with those applicants to try to resolve any sticking points and see how we can get them to that finish line. And some technological advancements, you may have heard of Decision Engine. This will help applicants pinpoint exactly what permit and submission documents they need for their projects. This is something that IT is working on, the procurement and the legal part of it, and you'll hear more about it down the line. Virtual inspections, we plan to further explore video technology to conduct inspections, which can save time and resources. And lastly, implementing real-time inspection route tracking and ETA estimated time of arrival notification sent to customers with scheduled inspections. And that's it. We're committed to all of you and the community on ongoing improvements to make the permitting process as efficient and painless as possible.
Great. Thank you, Natasha. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. I know that there's a lot of changes in the building department. What I'd like to recommend is to have this item be an LTC moving forward, and that way we have it hard copy, looking at it, and can respond to the department as needed. Are my colleagues okay with that?
Yep.
Okay, let's close this out. Number 7 is also the building department.
Yes, so this was first heard in February of 2023. The commissioners had a concern regarding complaints received from residents and small businesses having trouble getting permits and BTR from the county. And so the request was to work with the county to get a dedicated person to assist with that. So the county did commit, this was May 2023, to providing like a concierge type service to Miami Beach residents and businesses that need assistance. And so the county put that together. They reported that they didn't have any requests up until now. We have expanded, or the county has expanded their commitment and now has an in-person representative from the county that sits in the building department once a month, also third Thursdays of the month. So
Tomorrow they will be here, and they're here from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. So any resident or business owner that has a question on county permitting, how to get the permit, how to get a BTR, or if they're stuck, can come over to the building department. Again, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Thursday.
And has the building department worked with communications to make sure that the public is aware of this?
Yes. Yeah, so we have a constant contact list of about 30,000, and we send emails out to everybody on that list about the service.
Okay, great. Is there any public comment on this?
There are no public
colleagues.
Comments.
Thank you. We can close this up. All right, number 20.
Okay, number 20 is a police item, and it is an update on the Barkley Plaza Police Watch and safety enhancements, and we have police presenting the item. They are transitioning into the rooms.
Okay.
And thank you all for working with us in this space. No, it's not in the chamber.
And while we're waiting for them to come in, come on.
How are you, Tina?
I'm good. Good. Wages from police department. Last year, just filling in for them. We thought I was going to be presenting to you. He's just walking over. I figured I'd take the opportunity to say hello.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Valentine's Day.
He's here. There he is.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning, everyone. Major Daniel Wardella from the police department.
How are you doing?
I'm excellent. Thank you. So we are calling number 20, correct?
Correct. The bar fee.
Okay. So happy to provide you whatever information you need. I know that in 2023, we had over 800 calls for service at that location.
Watch and safety. What enhancements have been made?
So from the police department perspective, we have a standing watch order at that location. Three to four times a day, we have officers out there checking. At one point, we had them checking hourly, and unfortunately, that wasn't sustainable based on resources. So as I said before, in excess of 800 calls that we had there, the majority of which are self-initiated calls when officers go to check that property, they advise the dispatcher it initiates a call. We are continuing to maintain our watch orders there. I know a fence has been erected around the building, and we are doing everything we can. As soon as a breach is detected, we notify the proper folks at building to come and repair any type of breach in the surrounding area of the building. And that's where we stand right now.
Anything major that's happened in the last month?
No, so far we haven't heard
from residents either. So yeah, I think
right now it's
doing a great job. Yeah, thank you. Any comments on the bar?
Yeah, quick questions. Are we using this interchangeably with an entire area, or we're quite literally talking about one property?
We're talking about the Barclays property.
Yeah, this particular one.
That's insane. And nothing gets you.
And really,
100 calls to one single property.
It's come as a result of obviously the complaints that we have all received from the neighbors. Whether it was homeless people that were establishing squatting in the building and using it as a springboard to conduct criminal activity in the area. Several occasions last year, we actually had to clear the building using our SWAT team because it's so dangerous inside the building with the decay of the building itself that it's difficult for us to send regular officers. So we have to send officers to basically clear the building of anyone and then secure it and then conduct the watch order. So it's kind of what brought us to the point where we're at right now.
I'm sorry that we've collectively failed in activating this property that puts the onus on your resources that could be deployed elsewhere. Chief, are there any other properties throughout this is baffling to me. Any other properties throughout the city to dedicate this amount of resources that should be put under our radar?
Sir, off the top of my head, no, but I imagine some of those calls for service as well was self-initiated. It's a one-point board check the property hourly on each shift. So you multiply that by 30 days, for example, you get that whatever that number is. And so some of those calls may be attributed to that, but off the top of my head, I can't say there's another single property that has that many calls for service.
Yeah, I think... While you've seen a theme from our commission of demanding more from our police department. We also have a role to play in legislative policies, in not creating an environment that is conducive to these quality of life issues that are a drain on your resources. And that's certainly an initiative that I look to run for. So it's truly a two-way street where when we expect the best from you, we need to position our police department to not be responding to vacant abandoned properties in the heart of our city that have been dormant for or vacant for 10 or 15 years that are creating this issue. So thank you for being on top of this. And hopefully we look to push forward some legislative policies that help to put an end to this.
Any public comment?
We do not have any public comment.
Thank you for the update. We'll close this one out. Number 21 is also a police item.
Number 21 is discuss take action regarding the police department staffing plan and approach towards enforcement of speeding violations and drivers who operate their vehicles in a reckless or careless manner, and any recommendation to enhance enforcement for these defenses.
Good morning once again. Major Daniel Moriello on behalf of the police department. Traffic enforcement is a very high priority for our organization, as it is for the members of this committee, commissioners, and the residents of our city. And we take traffic enforcement and traffic safety extremely seriously. So in 2023, we wrote in excess as an agency of 61,000, almost 62,000 citations, of which 2,000 of those were for careless driving. Another 52 were for reckless driving. So it is a high priority. Obviously, we have a limited amount of resources. We've expanded our motor unit in the last few months from 12 officers to 15 officers to provide us additional motor officers. Our accident investigation unit is extremely active at conducting enforcement activity during their outside hours or off hours through grant funding through multiple different sources. It is our accident investigation unit that initiates most of our noise enforcement and abatement team enforcement actions. And we have requested a budget enhancement as an organization in the next fiscal cycle to see if we can further expand our traffic enforcement capabilities as an organization. We would love to have dedicated traffic enforcement officers whose sole duty is to go out and enforce the traffic laws and hit the different hotspots throughout the city in coordination with our real-time information center so that we can send the problem solvers to the problem locations as quickly as possible.
Thank you. And I've heard recently from residents in North Beach that some of the traffic violators are scooters and motorcycles and things of that nature. And I know that Assistant Dillis Freya is on the case for that one. So I appreciate that. Is there any public comment?
We do not have any
colleagues.
Major, are there any technological enhancements that the department is collectively looking at? Because we do have a finite amount of resources, and you know we are asking to do more with maybe the same or slightly enhanced. But are there ways where we can essentially look to technology to leverage?
So recently, we started to look at the request of the full commission a related item, which is the pursuit intervention item, where the vehicle could be equipped with a beanbag, essentially, that is used to tag a fleeing vehicle. So we're looking at that. With regard to traffic enforcement specifically, our department technologically is very well equipped, but we could always use additional technology in the form of lasers to enforce speed.
We don't use laser in that.
We do, but we can always use more equipment. And more equipment affords us the opportunity to train more officers and to deploy more lasers.
How many lasers do you need?
I honestly don't know.
Sorry, I don't know.
Oh, yeah, that answers.
Is it less than 10? Or?
Don't have an accurate answer. So I can find out.
Okay, and yes, and through the chair. Two quick questions, Major. In terms of technology that's not labor intensive, right? So almost the equivalent of red light cameras through speed detection or noise detection. I hope we're keeping our eyes and ears open there. And then can you clarify, do the LPR readers, and I know that this isn't exactly on traffic enforcement, but I think it's loosely related, Do those actually sit under your purview in your department?
Yes, sir.
Okay, they are. And how many LPRs do we have?
We have an LPR station at every entry and exit point to the city, as well as 6th Street and Washington Avenue. So I believe we're up to 7 or 8.
We actually have 22 fixed LPR locations in the city. Then we also have portable ones.
And those portable ones, do they fall within the police department? Because,
yes.
Okay, I've heard that we have mobile LPRs that are currently down.
We also have LPRs in cars as well. As
do some of those sit within the traffic and parking department, or are all LPRs with police?
All with police.
Okay. I appreciate it.
Any public comment?
We do not have any public comment.
So this item, do you want to move it to commission?
I have an item on this commission on February 21st, to discuss, and I'd like to discuss when all the colleagues are there.
Okay, so we can close this one out, and then your item will then take over at the commission.
Correct.
Okay. I'm just going to read the police department update of the committee item.
Correct.
Included.
So number 23 is also a police item.
Okay, and it is discuss the feasibility of the city establishing a crime laboratory to test suspected controlled substances impounded by the police department.
Major.
Good morning. So I believe there was a resolution that was discussed at commission that was to enter into an MOU with the Miami-Dade County Lab for our city to fund two positions for lab technicians to work specifically on Miami Beach related cases. I believe that where we are as an organization right now is negotiating the MOU of how that's going to work in part as far as payments for those positions and what clearly delineating what the city and the taxpayers are getting for this investment to the county.
So
there is an item that did go to commission last commission meeting, and it did get approved by the entire commission, and the wheel is already in motion.
Yeah. So this can be closed out because we have the other item. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
All right. So number 12.
Amending the RF3 zoning district regulations in the Miami Beach Residency Code to adopt a 12 a.m. outdoor termination time for the sale and consumption of alcohol beverages at alcoholic beverages establishments along the east side of Collins Avenue from 63rd Street to 72nd Street.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
So this item was referred to committee at the request of our colleague, Commissioner Bond. I think she probably wanted to learn more about this item. Perhaps I'd suggest deferring this item to such time that Commissioner Bond can be in attendance.
Did the commissioner ask to defer this item?
Not this one. She had requested to defer the micro mobility, and I had copied her in the email. She had not requested to close out.
Okay. Yeah, with this one, and I did some research into it, it's prospective.
Right.
So it's not going to affect the Sherry Frontenac. Who were the ones back?
There were two. Sherry Frontenac has a 5 a.m. I don't know if they serve alcohol outside past 5 a.m. Or until 5 a.m. And then there's the Cabana building at 6261 Collins that also had a 5 a.m. I don't know if they've renewed their BTR, but assuming they didn't abandon it, they would also have to currently.
Right. So I would be concerned if I was affecting existing businesses, but because it's prospective, that's why I was okay with it. Is there any public comment?
Right now, we do not have any public comment online. And
colleagues?
And Madam Chair, just for the benefit of the public, I mean, this applies to the east side of Collins that is more residential in character. And this would be then consistent with the policies we've been advancing through your leadership south of Bid of rolling back alcohol sales there that we're advancing in West Avenue, in Belle Isle, that we've advanced for the 41st Street corridor. this aligns with that.
Vice Chair Suarez?
Just curious, why 12 and not 2? I mean, isn't that the standard that we roll back hours to?
Well, this is outdoor. This is outdoor termination time. And so with outdoor, we've usually been a little bit more restrictive.
Yeah.
Because it's residential.
I move the item.
Okay. All in favor?
This forward with a favorable recommendation.
Yes.
And Madam Chair, just as a point of clarification, this was a dual referral, so we'll go directly to the planning board.
Excellent.
And one clarification I wanted to make is, as drafted, because it was outdoor only, it would apply to an existing business that has a 5 a.m. license. But if you want it to be prospective only, we could remove anybody that had a previous BTR as of this date. I'll leave it up to you, but as drafted, it would apply outdoors only to those two existing businesses.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm fine. Okay, so we're going to skip number 24 because I gave them a time certain of 1 o'clock. So let's move to number 14.
Okay, so number 14,
And with number 14, I would like to co-sponsor this item.
You would like to? Okay, I'll make a note that you will be co-sponsoring, and number 14 will be environment and sustainability, and Public Works will be presenting. The item is discuss, take action, referral to the Public Safety and Neighborhoods of Quality and Life Committee to discuss the protection of Biscayne Bay and enhancements of public health and city's resiliency by prioritizing and expediting the implementation of water and sewer infrastructure projects in the city.
What number was this item again?
14.
Did you notice that we also reached out to the next?
You wanted to.
Hi, well, good afternoon, Madam Chair and Commissioners. Amy Knoll, Chief Resilience Officer. I'm happy to provide a brief background on Biscayne Bay and the policies we've advanced, and then I will turn it over to Joe to talk a little bit on our water and sewer infrastructure. As you all know, Biscayne Bay is a very sensitive aquatic reserve right in our backyard, and it requires a regional approach to tackle some of the serious water quality issues that we are seeing. The health is a major concern and a priority for our city, as well as the county, the region, and the state, quite frankly. High nutrients are one of the major issues impacting the bay, and addressing it regionally is important because we have aging sewer infrastructure, we have aging septic tanks on the mainland, but not on Miami Beach, we have fertilizers, and we have decaying organic matter. So we have implemented a lot of protections, and we continue to work with the county and municipal partners. So in 2019, you may all remember there was a very significant fish kill for the bay. The Miami-Dade County Attorney General created a grand jury who issued a report. Subsequent to that, Miami-Dade County, the Board of Commissioners created the Biscayne Bay Task Force, and they issued a report. We invited that staff to come and present to the City Commission at that time, and they did so. And they also created an advisory board, the Watershed Management Advisory Board, that exists to this day. And our own commissioner, Alex Fernandez, is actually a member of that board, and we participate in those meetings. They recently issued a report that the bay has $94 billion annual economic value to Miami-Dade County. So our progress in some of this work over the last few years, we adopted a fertilizer ordinance. We were the first city to do so in January of 2021 to reduce the nutrient loading. The county subsequently also adopted their own a few months later. We also created a water quality ordinance. So we have an inspection program that regulates construction sites to help reduce their impact to the bay. And we also passed a seawall ordinance. And that's important because low seawalls allow water from the bay to overtop to bring in all those pollutants and put it right back into the bay. We also have a national pollutant discharge elimination system program where we do an annual report. It looks at the different results. It looks at our different activities. And we do very well with that program. For example, we clean our stormwater system about once a year, and only once every 5 years is required. We also are a leader in habitat restoration. So we are designing our new parks and green spaces in a way that incorporates ecosystem benefits. I'm sure you're all familiar with Brittany Bay and where we skid at Bayshore Park. We've also engaged a consultant who provided a report on how we can integrate living shorelines in our own city segments. We have to acknowledge that 91% of seawalls are privately owned,
but we're doing everything we can. And we're also doing projects like the Reef Line, our U-Link project, working with the University of Miami with the hybrid reef off of the coast of North Beach. We've had a lot of education and outreach. We did a Biscayne Bay, We Heart Biscayne Bay campaign that was launched in 2022. We hold certain events like Yappy Hour. We talk about don't fertilize the bay, don't be rough on the bay, and also don't be trashy. So we utilize these campaigns for our visitors and residents. And then we also have our plastic-free program as well, which is important for our businesses. So with that, just a little overview of some of our policy items, and I'll hand it over to Joe.
Morning, Madam Chair, Commissioners. Joe Gomez, Public Works Director, for the record. So in terms of our water and sewer program, we've done quite a few projects over the past couple of years. Our critical needs now has grown to about $300 million in terms of projects. We have about 85% of those projects underway in either planning, the design phase, or construction. Upgrades to multiple pump stations throughout the city. One of our big projects was the Dave Boulevard horizontal directional drill that replaced the existing force main that had multiple breaks. We've also completed the first phase of the Venetian Causeway, both for the water main and the sewer main, and a sewer force main replacement. The second phase, which is the large phase that takes us all the way to the city of Miami limits where we connect, that will start construction later on this year. And that's critically important because of the county's ongoing project with the Venetian Causeway Bridges. In addition to that, we've got trenchless, what we call trenchless rehabilitation of our sanitary sewer systems, where we do pipe lining. We've done a significant amount in the Parkview area, completed about 90% of the pipes in Parkview and about 30% of the manholes. Now we're moving over to the east side of the Parkview area, called the Parkview Extended Area. Continue that pipelining program, which in essence will not only extend the useful life of the pipes, but it will also prevent leaks from occurring in our gravity sewer system. We've increased our sanitation deployment in the particularly in Parkview area where we had issues to 3 times a week. We do street sweeping as well as hand collection. We've installed rain domes on a lot of the trash litters so that the garbage doesn't leak out of the containers and other multiple projects. We've got other projects that are currently in design, including the North Beach Town Center project, which is currently in the design phase as well.
I have a question. Thank you for the update, both of you. And I use an app to see water quality around the city. The Miami Water Keeper is the one that collects the water. I don't think that there's one for behind West Avenue. Can that be added so that we see the water quality there as well? It's Sunset Harbor, Collins Park. The app I use is Swim Guide.
Yeah, so that is actually run by the Miami Water Keepers. We could reach out to them and share that with them. It's a nonprofit advocacy group, and it relies on volunteer sampling.
Okay.
Happy to reach
colleagues,
out.
Any comments? Vice Chair?
Yeah. So particularly around West Ave, are the new infrastructure, do they have injection wells?
The upcoming project for West Avenue, yes, sir. It not only has a brand new pump station that's currently under construction right now,
yeah,
but the project will also have a water quality wells as well.
Okay. And so if you can explain, just to educate us, what's the purpose of an injection?
Injection well essentially is a form of treatment for water quality. So as the first flush comes into a pump station, stormwater, we're talking strictly stormwater, not sanitary sewer. So stormwater comes into the station. If there's not a water quality treatment mechanism, there's no outfall, then that goes into the injection wells. That's treated.
Percolates down.
Yes, yes, sir.
And also, and some of the voters are here, and they made posts showing they claim that there's sewer water going into the bay. It hasn't rained. Is that sewer water going into the bay, or is that tidal water?
We do not discharge any sewer unless there's a break, for example. And if there's a break, that's unavoidable, but that it happens. But sanitary sewer flows are never dumped into any water for the city of Miami Beach or any water that I know of in Miami-Dade County.
If I could, Madam Chair. With what you said for the West Avenue, so
yes, sir.
Going forward at the pace that we're currently going and even expediting that, not only is it critical to our resiliency efforts that we continue these projects, but also to the environmental quality of the bay.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Stephanie, any public comment?
There is a public comment in Venice.
I wanted to... About that, if you guys...
Your name and...
Carlos. Yeah. Carlos Leon. I live in 920 Jefferson Hill. About the West Avenue pumps, I pass there every day. It's on every day. The smell is disgusting and throwing the water. Why don't you, with the people that you guys work with, the water, why don't you guys grab the water coming out of that pump and check if it is having wastewater? Because we pass there every day. We can't breathe during those times. Passing that canal, passing the... By the 10th Street, they have one. They have one on the 14th one. And every day they're on. And it hasn't been raining for how long?
Yeah.
So I think that water is coming from somewhere. And we should check what's coming out from that water. And for the men.
Thank you for the feedback.
Thank you.
I can address the issue of the pumps being on. As you know, we live in a burial island. Groundwater levels come up, so as the groundwater infiltrates into our system, the pump automatically will, because that water will seep into our drainage system, so the pumps will kick on and work.
And the odor of it is?
And a lot of it is a decomposing, decaying mangrove. Yes.
Especially that part of the city is the lower, the man-made part of the city that were mangroves.
Correct.
And were built over mangroves there.
So yeah. Thank you for the update. I appreciate it. So the action that would be taken, if my colleagues are okay with it, is for the Environment Department to check and see if the Miami Water Keepers can add West Avenue so that we can check the water quality there. Okay.
Was the mayor seeking, any other action from this item? Should the committee maybe keep it open in case he wants to comment on the side base? It seems like it was an important item for him.
He didn't ask for a time certain, and he didn't show up, so for his team.
The item was an update.
Yeah, thank you. All right. So let's close this out. And then item number six, which is also your department.
Okay, item number six is discuss options for incorporating solar energy installation as part of city's capital projects.
Well, thank you again, and good afternoon, all. I can provide a brief update of how the city is approaching solar energy and options that are being provided by facilities and CIT. Madam Chair, I know this is your item. I'm not sure if you wanted to say anything before you begin.
No, please.
Okay, great. So our recommendation is to fund about $800,000 within the fiscal year 25 budget to start our first pilot program for solar. But just to walk you through some of the things that we have been doing, as you know, the City of Miami Beach has been compiling an annual greenhouse gas emissions inventory since 2014. And the data shows that emissions from buildings and the built environment is by and far the largest source of energy consumption to greenhouse gas emissions in our city, which is very different than other cities, that most of our emissions come from transportation. In 2021, our city commission did unanimously adopt a resolution pledging to achieve net zero emissions by 2050 for our city. As we know, this contributes to a warming climate, extreme heat, and also causes the ocean to expand and ice over land to melt, both of which cause a rise in sea levels. And our average elevation is only 4.5 feet NABD, and we do face risk from many sources of flooding. So this is a way for us to reduce our emissions, to enhance our resilience, and also provide a decentralized energy source during power outages or emergencies. To grow their use of solar, we did something really unique in 2019. We achieved a SolSmart designation. We tried to reduce the barriers to solar, so really addressing the soft costs. For example, we have waived the fees for permitting. We expedite the permitting for solar applications. We also waive fees for the land development public hearings related to solar. We have conducted a lot of best practice research in this area. Now, solar is not simple. It is new to an older city like ours. We met with Orlando staff. We've met with 98 County.
And cities are moving forward in piloted ways to try solar. In terms of existing facilities and existing buildings, Liz Miro and her team did take a look, and they came up with a few different options. Our fleet management building, the 17th Street parking garage, 1755 Meridian, and the convention center. Again, they have requested about $800,000 within the budget process to start to pilot solar at the fleet management facility. If approved, staff would work with procurement and work with the grants team to obtain those federal rebates as well. In terms of new capital projects, there's a lot of facilities that we could integrate solar. So the Marine Patrol Facility, we've got Flamingo Park Beach Center, the North Beach Ocean Rescue, Fire Station 3, the Bass Museum, Byron Carlisle, and the Fillmore and Art Deco Museum expansion. As part of design for the Flamingo Park Baseball Stadium, CFP has tasked the design consultant for solar to power some of the buildings. And the design phase for 72nd Street Community Complex is underway, and that scope of work does include solar. So there's a lot of opportunities here, and I'm just sharing this with you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
So this item came as a result of the Sustainability Committee having us look at ways to reduce barriers for solar. So what my recommendation would be is for the $800,000 a dollar recommendation for it to be reviewed during the budget process for 2025, if my colleagues are in favor.
Yes, those for the next budget process.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Stephanie, are there any callers, any public
right
comments?
We do not have any callers. And I don't
thank you so much, Amy. I appreciate the update. And we'll move on to number 15.
Okay, so for item number 15 would be presented by Public Works. It's to discuss upcoming Miami-Dade County Venetian Causeway Bridge projects.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. So I did receive an update from Miami-Dade County yesterday on the status of the Venetian Causeway project. The project is they just submitted the 60% plans for the Venetian Causeway for the replacement of all the bridges. They expect to have that complete the permitting and design phase by December of 2025. They expect to go to construction award in January of 2026. That process will take 8 to 12 months because of some of the long lead times of some of particularly for the mechanical bridge, the East Basket Bridge. And then the construction is slated to take approximately 5 years because it has to be done in segments and in phases. That's my update on the Venetian Causeway.
And that, you said that it's scheduled to begin in 2026.
In 2026, and that's critically important. And that's why we're trying to get our water main and force main. That's why we have the project that we're starting this fall, so that we can get out of their way, so that those pipes will already be subaqueous and out of their way so that they can come and replace those bridges.
And I appreciate the update. I know that they've been in contact with the buildings because I live in one of the buildings affected, and I appreciate our engineer being on those calls as well. And also the Venetian Island Homeowners Association has also been involved and aware so that they can be prepared for planning purposes.
Yes.
Commissioner Fernandez?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Great to see that this is moving forward. When is it that the signature bridge is expected to be?
Oh, goodness. Commissioner, the last update that I received from FDOT, I think right now it's not slated to be completed until early 2028.
Early 2028?
Yes.
Okay. So
that's a whole project.
That's a whole project.
Yes,
but clearly, with that project causes an impact in our city, because now people that would typically be taking 395 to head westbound towards downtown and other parts of Miami, now they're going either through the Venetian Causeway or through the
tunnels.
We see a lot of displacement in traffic as a result of that. So while the signature bridge is still going on, the county is going to start with the Venetian
in 26.
In 26.
Yes.
They're going to be overlapping with each other.
Yes.
That means that there's going to be then even more traffic heading on Alton Road towards the Julia Tunnel. This part of Alton Road is already failing. When you look at the map from FDOT, that part of Alton Road is already failing. Simultaneously, we have in the works the FDLT Outer Road Project.
Michigan to 43rd.
North of Michigan Avenue that I think is currently, the current timetable, sometime like in 2025, that's supposed to begin. And that's going to be a long project as well. I think we need to be looking at the overlap of these projects and the queuing of these projects so that they don't overlap. I think we should probably seriously be looking at this Alton Road project and be urging the state to queue it to occur after the Signature Bridge is over, at least, or wait until, you know, Venetian Causeway and the Signature Bridge projects are done, because traffic impacts are going to be horrible. And we haven't even begun speaking about the Collins Avenue project as well. It's great that we're doing these projects. We have to do these projects. We want to do these projects. But we can't bring the city to a standstill. So I think we should recommend, as part of this conversation, that the City Commission consider urging FDOT to consider the queuing, the timing of the Alton Road project to occur after the completion of the Signature Bridge and the Venetian College.
I agree. Project. Thank you, Commissioner Fernandez. We actually had that conversation with FDOT, you and I, with the two secretaries there, and I urge the city, please have that conversation with FDOT, because if not, our city is going to be complete gridlock with all of these projects simultaneously. FDOT is only worried about their portion of it. They're not looking at all of the other impacts that are happening. Colleagues?
Yeah, Madam Chair, would you like to work on a resolution that we could bring perhaps to the commission on that, to formally, as a body, as a city commission, urge FDLT to consider the timing?
Absolutely. And is there any public comment? It looks
we
like Melissa.
Yeah, we have one public comment.
Yeah. Hi, Melissa.
If you could unmute yourself for 2 minutes.
Hi, everyone. Thank you. Melissa Beattie from Venetian Islands Homeowners Association. Thank you for the update. I've been speaking with the county extensively and making sure that the impact on the neighborhood here isn't too drastic. We've already, Alex pointed out some of the considerations we need to do with some of the other projects across the city. And I would just like to add a few more things that we are concerned about. On the planning board, we recently approved a few new projects. Two different restaurants are opening up in West Avenue with a 200 plus seats, which we're going to be attracting more traffic. We have the Whole Foods that's going up around the Alton Road area. We have the new office building off West Avenue where the old Epicure is. So that whole area is going to be a bit of a gridlock, which is going to be worse than what peak hour to help with the traffic flow. And this is before these new businesses open up. So if we're adding on that, the construction of the Venetian, we're looking into a really big mess. And I'm not getting much cooperation from the county at this point in evaluating some of the possibilities of what we can do to alleviate the traffic across the causeway. I do understand it's a causeway and it's used for the overall general public, but it is a causeway going right across a residential neighborhood. So what I'm asking for is the city to help us in looking at some options and reducing the traffic during the period where we will be undergoing the replacement of the bridges. There will be bypass along the raising bridge, but for the other small static bridges, the understanding is that for most of the project, there will be periods where there will only be one lane open, so there will be lights alternating the traffic flow. So you can only imagine with everything coming up how what we're going to be dealing with trying to come home from work or with our children picking them up from school. And this is not a 3-month project. We're talking about 5 years. So what I'm asking again is for the city to work with us, with the county, to see if we can impose some sort of restriction on the causeway use to be prioritized for the residents by either looking into increased toll or whatever the city can suggest and work with us to look at the options of what we can do to make this bearable for the residents for 5 years.
Thank you, Melissa. So I will recommend that the city come back to this committee in April with your recommendation. You've been able to figure out whether it's a higher toll, closing it only to residents, an update for us then.
Yeah, and I will just add to that, I don't know if we make it part of the resolution or if my colleagues want to, but we just continue to really evaluate mass transit options that do not come with any type of significant infrastructure construction, because even when we talk about things like the Bay Link, then you can just add on another 10 years of construction on the causeway post that. So when we look at things, it could come without any type of significant infrastructure. It would further snarl traffic getting to the end. Things like electric ferries, maybe I fall short of the helicopter solution, but, you know, from the ferry standpoint, plus rapid transit.
Bryce? Same. Okay. So we'll bring this back in April, and then we'll move to number three, which is also public work.
Yes, Madam Chair. So this one was to discuss maintenance of traffic within all city roads. So just a little bit of context, I think it's important. So currently under our city code, and I think the city attorney's office may be here, they're here, so they can all address some of the legal issues. But we do have ordinances that allow us to provide specific hours where traffic can't be blocked. For example, rush hour traffic, we can't have any unless it's an emergency, it's a declared emergency, from 7 to 9 a.m. and 4 to 7 p.m. The tricky part becomes where you have roads that are either under the county's jurisdiction or the state of Florida's jurisdiction. Now, we have what I think is a very good working relationship with FDOT. FDOT has, in many cases, and most recently I can cite the Harding Avenue project, where their start time was slated for 7 a.m., and they moved it back to 9 a.m., because of the traffic impacts that were associated with that. Miami-Dade County passed an ordinance, I believe it's in 2022, that essentially said that any county facility that requires work, whether by one of its contractors for a county project or a utility contractor, they're not required to seek a permit from the municipality. I will tell you that we continue to require permits from our utility providers and from developers, whether it's a city or county street. And with FDOT, if it's an FDOT road, the utility company or the developer will have to seek the permit from FDOT first, and then FDOT tells them that they need a courtesy permit from us. So there is a check and balance in the system. We also have fees that we charge for private developers, depending on the designation of the road. If it's considered a minor street road, it ends up being like 33 cents linear foot per day. That's a fee that we charge. If it's a major road, for example, 41st Street, Alton, Washington Avenue, those are major, that fee significantly increases to $3.15 per linear foot per day. So as an example, for 300 feet, a minor street would be $99 per day, whereas a major street would be $945 per day. And those are the fees that we charge for it. So we continue, to stress, and we've worked closely with both Miami-Dade County and FDOT in terms of permits required, street closures. We do have and you receive the weekly LTC on all our MOT projects within the city. That is updated in real-time information. So when it's released on Monday, you get the notices of all the active lane closures within the city. Our inspectors go out and take appropriate action, work with code compliance to make sure that if there isn't a contractor that's blocking after that code goes down and charges them. And the fines vary. They start at, I think it's at $500, and they can go up to $10,000.
Okay. I should have a question. You mentioned that FDOT has the process where it's a courtesy.
Yes,
does the county have something similar? Because I had a situation that I had written to Jose Gonzalez about where at rush hour traffic, the county was doing work on Avid and 69.
And she contacted her neighborhood officer and never heard back. And it was a huge inconvenience since things like this happens all the time throughout the city. What can we do with county work?
Unfortunately, we had a lot more leverage prior to that ordinance that the county passed. And that not only affects us, but it affects every municipality within Miami-Dade County. My recommendation would be that this could be taken up again with the League of Cities, again, to bring it back to the county's attention, because I think the county, in doing that, has restricted our ability to be able to manage traffic flow, not just for us, for other municipalities as well, where projects actually flow, the impact flows into the city streets.
Okay. Any public comment?
Online, we do not have any public comments. Colleagues?
Okay, thank you for the update, and I'll work with the city attorney's office on what we can do for county stuff.
Will we keep this open? And
no, let's close this out. I'll bring something new that is needed. Okay, so the next item is number two.
And that is Miami Beach Drive.
And that's Alex. That's Commissioner Fernandez.
Alex is just fine. titles come and go. So this is an item that this committee and the City Commission has been working on for a while. I placed this on the agenda at the beginning of the request from MBNA to address immediate issues of, you know, questions on ownership, infrastructure issues.
I'm so sorry to interrupt, but Stephanie just told me that this was a time certain at 1:45. Is it okay to do it now, or do we need to wait?
It'll be great if we could do it now, because I have to be tend to something family related at 2.
Understood.
Yeah. So in essence, over the course of the last year, we put a lot of focus on Miami Beach Drive. I think we probably haven't invested a lot of city money on it since it's probably developed probably about 40 years ago, just kind of like band-aids. But in the meantime, last year, we went in, we look at issues with ballers, with lighting, with flooding, even questions about ownership. And we've been able to settle a lot of these issues. Now is the opportunity to see, okay, now that we've done the Band-Aid fix-ups, what is it that we can do for the future of Miami Beach Drive? MBNA, the Mid-Beach Neighborhood Association, has had a vision to transform this into a true promenade, providing more pedestrian-friendly facilities and better aesthetics. In discussing this matter with CIP and with Public Works, they suggested that we make an allocation of funding so that we can hire a company to engage in a feasibility study and put together a master plan for the revisioning of Miami Beach Drive. It truly is a special area in Mid Beach because it runs just adjacent to the beachfront, and it serves a lot of condominiums along Collins Avenue. And I'd appreciate it if the committee could consider recommending to the City Commission an allocation of up to $500,000 so that the city administration can have the funds necessary to do a feasibility study and a master plan.
So I think we have a caller from MBNA, Alicia Casanova. We can unmute her.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Alicia Casanova, representing the Mid Beach Neighborhood Association. And I know Oscar Vasquez, we thought it was at 1:45, so he's joining at 1:45. But since I'm here and listening, I'm just going to chime in. We are in full support of Commissioner Fernandez's initiative to allocate funds to begin this process in the immediate time. We need maintenance on Miami Beach Drive. We have seen a lot of problems going on with water and flooding and filth and so forth. But in the long term, it is a beautiful walkway that deserves to be treated as such. And anything the city can do to beautify it and make it another amenity for our Mid Beach neighborhood and for every Miami Beach resident, actually, it would be very appreciated. So we are in full support of Commissioner Fernandez's initiative. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Fernandez. I'm also supportive for an allocation that large. It probably should go to the finance department for their review. What do my colleagues think?
Yeah, the only question is it specifically for design, for design, or is it for cleanliness?
No, this isn't even for design yet. And perhaps VIP or Joe, you can be
I can certainly do that. So this is really to have a consultant do a feasibility study to look at Miami Beach Drive cohesively from 24th to 29th to come up with what would be the future look of Miami Beach Drive, whether it's part of it will be to look at the...
Is that going to cost $500,000, or is it $500,000 for the project as a whole?
No, that's $500,000 is for the study, for the feasibility study.
Let's run it through the...
I think this is much needed in many of our important corridors. I look at some places that are just urban planned with no rhyme or reason. We're sitting atop one right now, 17th Street. We have a daycare and a single family home across from City Hall, across from an office building that is right next door to one story. There is no rhyme or reason to a lot of our urban planning on many of our major corridors. I think this is a wonderful opportunity. The one thing that I would certainly urge is let's work with our private sector partners and stakeholders, and especially, I don't know if it's in these specific four or five blocks, but in other areas along Collins Avenue, we have some world-class developers doing world-class projects like the Raleigh and things like that. Let's see if they can engage because they have a vested interest in seeing an improved public rights of way. So let's include those private sector partners, especially to the extent where there's any of the condo buyouts that are possibly occurring in this area. Let's work to get them to deploy their capital. Right, you know, rising tide lifts all boats. Sorry, I don't want to make Amy nervous over there. No sea level rise, but just the gist of that. Let's really engage all stakeholders because one of the things that's incredibly frustrating, I know right on Lincoln Road, you have the city doing one thing and then you have developers doing kind of things where we could have all done that in cohesion and done one design properly. So let's really reach out, not just limited to government, but the private sector stakeholders that are working on very substantial projects at that area.
And if I may, through the chair, one of the great things about working with MBNA on this is that unlike many other neighborhood associations, they have also the commercial property owners that sit on in their organization. So they have the condominiums like Trident Towers and Oceanfront and the Riviera and all that are along that corridor who sit in the association, but they also have the hotels as well. And so in engaging in this discussion with MBNA, they're a part of this discussion. I would love to have a sunshine meeting with you separately about 17th Street, because 17th Street is actually something that we should have a meeting about. We don't need to be talking about the future of that. I'd say it would be great if this committee, Madam Chair, could consider recommending that as part of the budget process, we consider an allocation of up to $500,000. Not saying that we're going to use all of the $500,000, but giving them the opportunity to consider up to $500,000 as part of the capital budget process.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. How do my colleagues feel?
That's fine.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move this item.
Thank you, colleagues.
Thanks.
All right, so it's 1 o'clock. I think we have a time certain for number 24.
It'll be presented by Environment and Sustainability. It's going to be discussed pedestrian and bicycle safety on Beachwalk and any options for creating a bike path on the hard park sand to minimize the interactions between bicyclists and pedestrians on the Beachwalk.
Thank you, Lindsay.
Yes, good afternoon, Madam Chair, Commissioners. Lindsay Prex, the Assistant Director of the Environment Sustainability Department. I'm happy to provide an update on what we know and provide an overview of the details in the memo. These details have also been provided in a previous LTC and past committees. The administration has conducted research to advise on the regulatory requirements to establish a bike path east of the dunes along the hard path. As part of this research, we contacted the Florida Department of Environmental Protection for their requirements. Hard path is defined as a sand road, which is naturally occurring over time, west of the erosion control line that's used by public safety and other authorized vehicles. While sand compacts to varying degrees over time and over the length of the beach, The established hard pack that is recognized by the Beach Maintenance Division extends from 6th Street to 19th Street. Beyond these limits, it's reasonably understood that a beach cruiser with extra wide tires would be required to traverse through that sand. There are limitations on what can be permitted seaward of the dunes and on the beach. This area is east of the dunes, and it must follow the Coastal Construction Control Line, or CCCL, permitting requirements. As part of that program, which was established by Florida State Statute 62B-33, Chapter 161, which is titled Beach and Shore Preservation. One of the main intentions of that program is to safeguard the resilience of these natural systems and encourage the ability of the area to bounce back to these original conditions after a stressor. The CCCL program statute regulates structures and activities that can cause beach erosion, destabilize dunes, damage the uplands, interfere with public access, and the program also protects sea turtles and dunes. Since the city would be asking for what's considered a new activity under this statute, we would need to obtain approvals through the CCCL program. A bike path is considered an activity and changes the nature of the existing sand. Through that permitting process, we would need to prove that there would be no impact to sea turtles pursuant to the Endangered Species Act of 1973. Sea turtles nest in soft sand, therefore we need to prove that the establishment of this bike path would not change their nesting habitat. And the Biffin hard path is utilized by sanitation and emergency services, so it would have to be planned so as not to interfere with this.
I just want a point of clarification. I know that MBNA has been advocating for this item, and they've been advocating for pedestrian, not a bike path, and they wanted clarification on that language. I believe MBNA is on.
Of course, yeah. If we were to allow pedestrians or bicyclists to use the beach as it currently stands, that would not be considered a new activity. But if we were to construct a path that would make it easier or be considered an official path, whether it's a Moby mat or some sort of brick structure, that would be considered a new activity. However, if we as a city would allow pedestrians and bicyclists, that's where that differentiation comes into play. Vice Chair.
How much of a buffer is there between the dunes and the intended bike path or the walk path, the hard pack sand?
It's very limited. It depends on every single area, but pretty much as soon as the dunes end, there's that natural compaction that happens over time.
And how wide would it be?
It's enough for vehicles to traverse. I'm sure beach maintenance could provide the exact width.
Commissioner Fernandez?
Okay, so for it not to be designated a new activity, I'm sorry, could you repeat that? What would not be designated as a new activity?
So if we as a city decide to allow pedestrian bicyclists to use that area without changing the nature, so if we were just say, like, okay, it's allowed now, they would be able to use that area. Whereas if we installed anything to officially make it easier for people to utilize it as a path, that would be considered an activity.
So it's the physical installation.
Correct.
Okay. And there's no way to be able to compact the sand that's already there without installing anything?
It naturally occurs over time. So it's just that natural fluctuation of the system.
So it's the designation that we allow bicycles on there that is the hurdle?
No, it's the activities that would make it easier for people to use, because right now the only official hard pack is that 13-block section.
What I was going to say, what if we don't say necessarily that it's for bicycles, and if we don't say that, can we move forward with this? And not have to go through a permitting process?
If we just allowed residents or visitors to utilize this area, then we would not need to go through the state. But if we change the nature of this segment, then we would.
But you need something for them to walk up because you have very soft sand.
And that's...
So the moment we actually compact the sand, regardless of what our intention is or what we telegraph, we have to go through the permit. And how long is that process?
It depends on their workload at any given time. Special events permitting, which are typically smaller in nature, can take a 2 to 3 month period. The beach walk, which also required CCCL permits, was a much longer time frame. I'm sure David can give that exact time frame.
And what is the area or the streets for this item in particular? Is it all of Miami Beach?
This area was just a general discussion item to provide any research we were able to obtain from the state.
Well, I mean, personally, I think it'd be great to have a beach hard pack sand for bicyclists to use. It's lovely. And so, I would want to move forward.
Yeah, same here, but I believe we have some public comment. Can we get Alicia?
So if we could unmute Alicia, so I have 2 minutes.
Okay, I'm back, and I'm listening to this interesting conversation. So let me understand this. We if we compacted the sand, let's say 6 feet wide east of the dunes, just compacting, there's areas that the sand is very soft and it's hard to walk by. We are not proposing anything to bicyclists. First of all, would probably not enjoy, and they probably won't be going to the beach beach to ride a bicycle, whether it's soft or hard. They don't like to ride on sand. So we're not advocating for bicyclists to use it. We're advocating for an alternative to pedestrians, that when the beach walk is crowded and full of bicycles, that they can comfortably go access this particular area and just walk. It's the same sand. It's not going to interfere with sea turtles because it'll be made of sand. I don't know. That's up to you if you want to add P-Rock like they have in Bal Harbour, which they have these walkways from Surfside to Bal Harbour made of sand compacted with P-Rock. And then providing an alternative, anybody that wants to walk there. Right now, anybody can walk through that area, right? It's the beach, so we all walk it. The difference is that the city will make it easier to walk it by compacting the sand. Would that require CCL and this whole bureaucracy just to compact the sand, we're not even saying the word bicycles. I mean, we know that bicycles, to get bicycles out there would be dangerous, actually, because you have the bridges connecting the beach walk to the beach. And if you have bicycles traversing east of the dunes, that's kind of dangerous. People are walking, you have to cross a bicycle path. No, that's not, the language was erroneously written in this item. So I think that's very clear what Commissioner Dominguez said at the beginning. So that can be corrected to say just a beach pedestrian pathway made of compacted sand. We're hoping or assuming that this could be done without extensive cost or extensive bureaucratic processes from CCL or from anybody else, because it's really just using the same sand except compacted. Is that something that we're on the right path to advocate for?
I think the idea is, what is the path of least resistance to get this?
Well, the state would review any application that we put forth. Just know that they would not be able to approve any application that does not meet every requirement of the state's statute.
How did it get compacted between 5th and 17th or 19th?
It's naturally occurring. So the structure of the beach in that area is a little bit different. There's a lime rock layer, and just consistently over time, it can compact a little bit better there.
And I think we have another public comment. Henry Stoller, are you here for that item?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for accommodating me on time today. My name is Henry Stoller. I live at 1500 Ocean Drive, where I have lived for 19 years full time. Everything that I'm going to testify to today is based on my personal experience and personal observation over an extended period of time. 2 or 3 times a week, I leave my home on 15th Street. I bicycle up to the city limit at 87th Street, turn around, and come back. All I'm talking about is my personal experience and observation. Occasionally, I will take the shorter route and come out of 15th Street, turn right, and go down to MacArthur, and turn around and back. I'm well familiar with it. I encourage you to abandon pursuit of a parallel bypass. The proposal here is well-meaning, well-intentioned, made in good faith, in recognition of the fact that the beach walk's location and beauty have made it the victim of its own success. But the proposal does not address the real problem. Bikes are not the principal problem. The beach walk was built for bicycling, which is completely legal. The real problem is motorized devices, which are completely illegal. So we have turned this on its head and not addressed the problem of people who are out there acting illegally on all manner of dangerous motorized devices, and instead are addressing bicycles for whom this was built. There are huge differences in speed and weight between a motorized device and a bicycle. Please reflect on whether you'd rather be hit by a bicycle or a motorized device. There's quite a substantial difference. Here are six additional reasons for abandoning this concept. The staff report is miraculously wonderfully good. It is polite, it is circumspect, it is deferential and respectful. But plainly, trying to pursue this effort would take the administration into a regulatory morass. The report is too polite to say that, but it's perfectly clear that's the message. We'd be looking at years and costs. We are already on LTC number 8 on this modest little project of closing the north 2 blocks of Ocean Drive in order to create the little promenade there. This is going down the rabbit hole based upon my reading of the law as set forth in the staff memorandum. It's a great piece of legal writing. The staff report also reminds us that the beach walk took 19 years and in yesteryear dollars cost $45 million. There would be more engineering challenges and therefore greater costs when building directly on the beach because there would be no protection from the sand and wind. The beach walk has some natural protection from the dunes and the vegetation on the dunes from blowing wind, blowing sand. This will be out naked in the open with no tree cover to protect people from the sun, as the beach walk in many segments provides. And so it's going to be longer, costlier, and probably unable to be fulfilled.
Thank you, Henry.
May I have one more minute, please?
We gave you that 4 minutes.
You're at 4 minutes, so I'll give you 30 seconds.
Okay. All right. There'll be more maintenance because there'll be far more blown sand. More destructive of a feature of the natural environment. We tore out a huge section of the beach walk, pardon me, of the dunes and of the vegetation to build 3rd to 5th Street on the beach walk. This repeats that assault on our environment. The cost of enforcement will almost double because now we're going to have categories of violations. You were on the wrong walk. It should be on the bike path. It should be on the beach path. Madam Chair, if I may have 15 seconds to say, we should not seek brand new projects to address the beach walk's problems. First, as the mayor suggests, some portions of the beach walk might be widened. Secondly, Jose Gonzalez is working diligently and doing a fabulous job on better signage, more striping, more directional arrows, and he's gotten $200,000 into this year's budget for that purpose. Third, we need better enforcement, and that's the subject matter of item 22 to be heard next month. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I'm going to have to leave soon, but I listen. We have hard packed from South Beach all the way to about 24th Street. I can tell you that at 24th Street, I start to become part of the traffic because then I transition over to the beach walk. I think, you know, there was vision 19 more years ago when someone had the vision to start working on the beach walk. It took years, it took decades to get it done, but eventually we got there. At some point, we need to have to start a conversation, even if it takes us down a bureaucratic process, a horrible regulatory process. At some point, we need to start the process of just saying, hey, listen, let's continue the hard pack, or let's put the pad down, and let's just try to get approval from the state to do that pad. From what I'm seeing here, you know, the state will have to determine whether it's going to cause adverse impacts to the dunes or erosion or other stuff. I don't think, you know, putting continuing the hard pack that already exists further north is going to do any of this. And I think as a commission, we should start that process. I respect Henry very much. I think his comments about motorized vehicles is accurate, but the real problem on the beach walk is that it's overcrowded. It's overcrowded, and we need capacity. The only way that we're going to get that capacity
is if we go out into the sand.
Okay.
I fully agree with
move it to the commission.
I would like to move it to the commission.
Yeah, and I would just say I don't look at these as mutually exclusive. Even if there weren't overcapacity issues, I just look at this as some sort of added amenity.
Yep.
Because it is such an attractive place, and what better way to be able to utilize that? So, Mr. Stolling, you have my utmost respect, and you have my commitment that pursuing this path will not mean that we do not continue to look for enhanced enforcement mechanisms on our beach walk as it exists. I don't look at this as creating some sort of easy way out to skirt enforcement. This is just something that could just be an enhanced amenity, and it is not because we're looking to skirt the responsibility of the beach folks. So thank you for your always well thought out input.
Thank you. So move to commission, please.
Favorable.
With a favorable recommendation. And number nine.
Okay, item number nine is a public works item. It discuss pressure washing in order to improve the cleanliness and aesthetic of the city property.
Madam Chair, in the memo that we provided to you, we detailed the efforts of our sanitation team in pressure washing, and I think we've outlined the specific areas that we currently target. And those will be the Lincoln Road Mall, both east and the west side, Mid Beach, North Beach, Ocean Drive, Washington Avenue, north and south.
Let me bring the maps. I have a map of the pressure. That's good. Give me a second.
Check.
Well, we'll wait for that. I don't know if Matthew has his hand raised for
it. I think it was for the previous one. But
happy to hear from him.
Hear from Matthew? Well,
Matthew, we moved on from the project, but we're going to have you share your thoughts.
Okay, thank you. And you can hear me now, correct?
Yes.
Correct. Okay. I want to say, of course, I know Commissioner Fernandez left, but, you know, I agree with Alicia from MBNA and Henry as well, who we've talked about the beach walk for many years. I'll be very brief, of course. I couldn't agree more with you that there's capacity issues on the beach walk. It is a victim of its own success, and many people enjoy it for recreation, but also for utility, whether they're commuting, whether they're taking their kids to school, or going, again, I'm repeating myself here, going to the doctor, going to a store, et cetera. One of the other options, of course, other than going on or in addition to going on to the beach is, again, building out our on-street bicycle network, which really hasn't seen much progress and success of being implemented over the last 5 to 10 years. So, again, I can just encourage you all to see what can be done to allocate more resources, whether it's staff and or money, to accelerate this amenity that many, many, many residents, if you look through all the surveys that the city manager's office does in 2019 and 2016, I think 2022 as well, safety on our streets is a number one priority. So whatever can be done by our elected officials to help spearhead that and make our streets more inviting, that will reduce the number of people on the beach walk.
Thank you, Matthew. Okay.
Back to the special order?
Yeah.
I don't know where you left off.
We just skipped it.
Sorry. Here. Well, I don't know if you want to do your presentation or you want to
show. I wanted to go through the, yes. So as Commissioner Suarez, this is a level of service map that we provided to our team so that we detail our levels of service depending on the area of the city. And that includes not only pressure washing, street sweeping, but also hand collection as well. So obviously, for example, if you go to level service A, that's probably the most intense. That's in,
down south.
Yeah,
down south. So, yes. So if you go down to, for example, the...
Can you help, Joe?
Oh, sorry. Yes. It's tough with this memory. So... The most intense areas that we do maintenance, obviously, are the high traffic areas, starting in the South Point area, as well as the Washington. Okay. So the Washington Avenue area, Collins Avenue, these areas carry not only pressure washing, but as well as street sweeping,
hand collection as well. And then, for example, in the residential areas, currently we do not provide any kind of pressure washing in any other residential areas of Miami Beach. We do pressure washing as well. We started our initiatives in the Palm View area, as well as areas of North Beach as well. We also do, during high-impact weekends, venues, we increase our pressure washing. We have 7 pressure washing units that are deployed throughout the city. Depending on the schedule, the pressure washing schedule starts at 4 in the morning to 12:30 p.m., and the reason for that is we don't want to be doing pressure washing when there's high activity on the sidewalk, because, again, it interferes, so we're trying to get it out of the way before we have a lot of high activity. And so that this kind of gives you an overview, and I'm sorry it wasn't attached to the memo, but it does provide the different level of service that we provide in terms of sanitation throughout the city.
So,
Chair?
You had to jump to that.
Yeah. So you don't do any pressure washing in residential neighborhoods?
No, sir.
Okay. And then also, we had discussions earlier. Yes. So hand crews 3 days a week, mechanical. And
yes.
So where you do pressure washing, it doesn't necessarily, I think where it says pressure cleaning 5 days a week, that doesn't necessarily mean that that particular area.
That is correct.
If I pinpoint on a map,
it's the entire area that would get 5 days a week. And that reason is pressure washing is a pretty slow operation. And typically, for example, on the Lincoln Road, it takes the entire day to do about 2 blocks for them to be able to do. So it's a slow operation by nature.
But there could be a situation where a section of the area, for example, A, within a 5 day period, doesn't get pressure washed. It could be anywhere in that zone gets 5 days.
If it's designated for pressure washing within that 5 day period, it will get touched within that 5 day period.
Every part of that of the zone.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But not every day. To your point, it's 5 days a week.
Within a 5 day period,
we cover the area in 5 days. In 5 days.
Okay.
Commissioner?
Yes.
Sure.
Yes, sir.
Understand the blanket assessment there, where you clean, where you do not. Are there areas in your assessment where not cleaning, where you look around the city, or your staff looks around the city and say, you know what, maybe we should really be doing here? I know personally, this is anecdotal, just people reaching out to me in the Flamingo Park area. And yes, when I see it walking down the street, the sidewalks there, yes, I'm like, wow, this is not how I picture Miami Beach. This is not the right level of cleanliness for our residents. I guess let's use that as an anecdotal example. What would it take to add that to maybe not 5 times per week, but to what would...
To do pressure washing, for example, in the Flamingo Park area, we would have to dedicate a team and a piece of equipment to that so that we could service it in the Flamingo Park area. Because, again, there's a lot of residential streets. We have the tree canopy, which presents a series of problems, leaves, and all that. So, one possibility is to look at, for the residential areas, and I think we had this discussion with Commissioner Suarez, is to maybe look at a model where we would do twice a year in residential areas.
Yeah, I think any resolution, I'd like to include that. For you to come back and say, these are, okay, this is the policy now, but I think I see the way the commission is, I hear the feedback of the residents, here is kind of threading that needle and add to this.
And of course, I have an item actually on the 21st to discuss the pressure. Yes. Yeah, it was actually tied in with the gum stain removal, but we never got that part of the item. So that dovetailed me. We're going to hear
excellent.
It again. Yeah.
All right. So we'll close this out. Thank you for the update. Thank you for the map. February 21st, we'll discuss it.
And the only suggestion that I would give to Public Works is, you know, I would really appreciate some maybe before and after pictures. So I know it takes you to do 2 blocks on Lincoln, take a before picture and take an after picture, because right now it's basically up to the supervisor to see if it's done or not. But you know, there are residents that complain, hey, my street isn't clean.
So if you have a before and after picture, you can say, hey, look, this is the timestamp we took a picture. It might have gone dirty after, but you know, we at least did our job. So I don't know if there's a
we can certainly do that. I get photographic information from the team once they complete an area, but we can certainly do the before and after. So,
great.
Okay, number 11.
Okay. I think that's my last one.
No, you got two more.
Oh, I got two more. Oh.
Great job.
All right, so number 11 is the item on blocking the dumpsters. So our team, our sanitation director and assistant director went out and looked at, and this was brought, I believe, by the folks in the ADNA area as well as Ocean Drive. So we looked at, and there's two things. We don't have an issue with blocking dumpsters. However, I don't think we should require all dumpsters to be locked. And the reason for that is a lot of these dumpsters go into enclosures. If it's inside an enclosure, there should not be an issue. Those dumpsters that, because the buildings are older and they don't have enclosures for dumpsters, then we would have no objection to have those having locks. And we can prescribe that as part of our RFQ or RFP process going forward for sanitation services.
Right. So, because if we were to do that, then it would be an extra charge because they'd have to get out of the truck and go in a lug of it. I don't recommend this at this time. I appreciate the update on that. Is there any public comment?
Mark, anybody?
Yes.
Mitch Novick. How do we get him? Okay.
Hi, folks. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good afternoon. I manage a building on 6th and Jefferson, and my neighbor has a lock on her dumpster. And unfortunately, her tenants are lazy and fill up my dumpster as quickly as it is emptied. So I think it's a bad idea to require locks on trash bins. Thank you.
Thank you, Mitch. Colleagues, do you have any thoughts?
There would just be more trash on the floor.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so thank you. Was just a discussion item regarding the use of secured dumpsters. The committee does not think secured dumpsters are the way to go.
So
we'll move this on. And I think we're approaching our last item. And I will tell you, my colleagues here, so when I had my briefing about this committee, I was told that it would take 6 months for us to get up to date because things weren't moving out of this committee previously. So we're approaching the last item. Thank you guys so much for
supporting me.
And maybe we'll get through the backlog quicker than 6 months. But I really appreciate it, Joe. Take it away.
Okay. So item 13, Madam Chair, is the discussed lighting improvements at the crosswalk of Pine Tree and Sharon in front of the Scott Rake House. So I had our operations team go out to take a look at the intersection to see what we could do, because obviously Pine Tree Drive is a county road. But based on the observations of my operations team, we can place one light within that general area, one city light, and work with FPL on attaching two additional lights on their light poles, on their electric poles, which would be a joint use pole. And I think we can substantially improve the lighting in that intersection. So if we're ready to proceed, if so would.
Colleagues, ready to proceed with their recommendation of that lighting?
Yeah.
Okay, Liz, any public comments?
You don't have any public comments.
All right, so I think
we've heard all the items for today.
All right, wonderful. Meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
That's quick. We're 30 minutes out of schedule.
Turn it off.
And this is for that.